Hey, baby.
Come here.
The party's over. You had to split. Some other time, huh? Same feeling, same place. Right now, I gotta take care of some business.
Been on.
He's asleep. Who wants him?
Wake him up. It's John Shaft.
You're really great, Zach. But, we're pretty shitty afterwards. You know that?
Yeah.
Look, I'm trying to take care of some business, baby, okay?
No. Come on.
Ben, I need two good men. You ready?
Yeah.
They better be tough. Hey, baby, please close the door, huh?
Hey. Close it yourself, shitty.
Hey, man, just tell me where and when.
In front of Cafe Reggio, down in the village. You know where it is?
Yeah, I'll find it.
12:30. 5 minutes later, it'll be too late.
I'll be there. Bye.
No time for chats.
You had time for a chat with Carmen and Patsy in my office this morning. You got me in one hell of a mess, John.
Did you have the room bugged?
Oh, no, not me. Me? I could turn the other way. Not hear what I heard. It's that big-eared captain I got who was listening. Thinks he heard you discussing a kidnapping. Thinks the mafia's involved. And he knows Bumpy Jonas is involved.
Tell him to ask Bumpy then.
But he wants to ask you now at the station. It's lousy timing, right?
You gonna take me in?
I will if I find you. Are you home?
Hell no.
That's too bad. Call me when you get home.
I will.
Close it yourself, shitty.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, October 21, 2021. So I have been told this is our weekly book study session, third installment on Ernest Tidyman's Shaft, written by a white man. So the audio segment that we just heard, that is from the 1971 Shaft film, Richard Roundtree. The segment that we heard is pretty much right in line with where we're going to be picking up this week. We're in the middle of chapter 5. The scene begins Shaft has Cowbell engaged in sexual intercourse with the white woman. Her name is Linda in the film. He comes back and he says, you know, hey, it's time for me. I have work to do. You got to split. So she says, you know, you're great in bed, sex machine, but afterwards you're kind of shitty. Comparing black people to feces, long staple of racism, white supremacy. So Shaft gets on the phone to call Ben Buford and to tell him, you know, get your people together. Don't be late. 5 minutes late is too late. Ben's like, you know, I'm getting it together. Linda goes to give him a kiss goodbye to leave. She goes out the door and he says, hey, you know, can you close my door, please? Asks her politely. She, close it yourself, shitty. And she leaves the door open as well. You know, like what they say, like a barn. That's what I would often hear people say, like, you're leaving the door open. Did you live in a barn? Or are you accustomed to being in barns? You just leave the door open? What's going on? Animals live in barns. So all that happens. He hangs up with Ben Buford. The enforcement official, Andrazi, comes to Shaft's residence right after the white woman has left. So he starts asking Shaft these questions and what have you. And Shaft says, hey, you know, it sounds like, do you have some sort of bug in my residence? Now, again, the book was published in 1970. The movie came out in 1971. This is right in the middle of COINTELPRO, the FBI's activities against the Black Panther Party, and pretty much any black people who attempted to work against the system of racism, white supremacy, where they were doing all sorts of illegal wiretaps, Dr. King and all kinds of folks. So to have that happen, and interestingly, yeah, the captain, he's got big, it's not me, Chad, you know, we're cool, it's not me, it's the chief. However, he was listening, and he confirms this by repeating what the white woman says. So you all have been listening to me engage in sexual activity with a white woman. I'd seen the movie before, but I had not really connected what was happening in that scene. Shaft isn't angry about this. He's not. What? He doesn't grab him by the cuff of his neck. You get those wiretaps out of here right now. What do you think you are? Wiretapping Shaft. What is this? You know? He doesn't say anything like that. He laughs about it. Oh, you were listening to me having sex with this white woman and my conversations about business and all this other stuff. Oh, okay, right on. What in the world? How can this happen? And again, how does something like that happen in the 1970s? And black people aren't thinking like, huh, that's interesting to have that in the film. And then, as I said, Shaft's response to, much like when the white man palms his behind in the same scene where Shaft meets Linda, this white woman in the bar, he doesn't get mad at that white man for fondling him. He doesn't punch his lights out or anything. Real passive guy, this Shaft. We will go ahead and get started. We'll hear a little bit of Isaac Hayes because he did win an Academy Award for this soundtrack, and then we'll push off into the text context of white supremacy, audio segment one.
Black man born free, at least that's the way it's supposed to be. Chains that binds him are hard to see, unless you take this walk with me. Place where he lives, he's got plenty of names. Slums, ghetto, and black belt, they are one and the same, and I call it any kind of job is hard to find. That means an increase in the welfare line. Crime rate is rising too. If you were hungry, what would you do? Rent is 2 months past due.
Andrazi and the commissioner were going back to the municipal termite nest that is the mayor's official residence, Gracie Mansion, when the phone buzzed in the back of the commissioner's limousine. There had been no sleep for either of them. Andrazi had stretched out on the leather couch in the commissioner's office for about an hour, but they had continued to talk and consider the reports coming in from the various divisions involved in the investigation. The commissioner insisted on dealing with the reporters personally in the sessions that followed. It was too wild for a lot of talking by uniformed deputies. Homicide said the area around 139th and Amsterdam had been cordoned off and shaken down, room by room, person by person. No witnesses to anything. Nobody knew anything. They heard some noises out there, and that was all. Just some noise in the night. They thought it might have been backfire. The commissioner had turned purple with fury. 5 of their own people cut down with machine guns, and it might have been backfire, he shouted, wasting energy. Androtsy kept his mouth shut. The ballistics crew said all the slugs had been 45s and fired from any one of a variety of automatic weapons. They had bushel baskets of ejected casings, painstakingly gathered from the streets, the hallways of the buildings where Shaft had gone to see Buford, and the rooftops of the tenements on each side. A pile of the slugs that had come from those casings had also been collected, dug from the tired walls of the buildings and from the flesh of 5 young men. The preliminary reports said merely that the bullets had come from the vast underground of weaponry. No one had expected them to say more. With calipers and microscopes and micrometers, the lab men would take the bullets along the paths of records to the origin of the guns. Eventually, weeks from now, it wouldn't mean much of anything when they reached the destination, except that the guns had been lost or stolen years ago and deposited against the moment of this need. What the hell was the difference? Androtsy thought cynically as he went through the reports. Machine gun was a machine gun. A dead man was a dead man. The commissioner picked up the telephone when it buzzed the rasping signal of a call. Black Mercury was turning off the East Side Drive just beyond the glimmering United Nations building, and Androtsy was letting his grainy eyes rest on the reflection swirling on the East River when the commissioner nudged him lightly with an elbow and handed over the phone. It's John Shaft. Tell that son of a bitch I'm not your secretary. Androtsy fought back a smile as he took the receiver and found the speak listen control button with his thumb. The commissioner would have misinterpreted the smile. He was weary, too. The circumstances in the city were pressing on him, but his inner smile was a signal of his own relief. As he had moved from one to another of the torn black bodies early in the torn black morning, Androtsy had expected one of them to be John Shaft's. The police commissioner is not my secretary, he said into the telephone. Uh-huh. Yes. Well, I'll tell him that. But let's talk about you before the FCC cancels our broadcasting license. Androtsy glanced at the commissioner as he listened, and then back to the cool early dusk that was settling on the streets through which their driver tooled with the careless confidence of a cop, hardly stopping for the red lights, letting the official look of the car help clear the way for them. No, Androtsy said. We don't. Not a thing. What about you? The car was coming up to the mansion now, pulling into the drive to seek a place among the other black vehicles that indicated the mayor's impatience with memos and telephones. A lot of his top people were there already. Where are you? Androtsy asked. I don't think it's the best idea you ever had, but I'll check. The car stopped. The commissioner's glance was a signal that the conversation had to end. They had to get inside. No, really, nobody is after Buford that I know of. He listened for a moment and then put the phone back with quiet agreement. Okay. Talk to you later. Androtsy climbed out after the commissioner. Shaft wants a line to the mafia, he said to the commissioner's back. Why? He isn't sure. He's crazy. Maybe. Can you give it to him? No. Are you going to find somebody who can? The mafia? Good Christ, what the mafia got to do with this? Who knows? For sure. The commissioner was about half a foot shorter than Androtsy. Had to cock his head back and peer up as he considered the question, standing on the entrance steps of the mansion. This is why I'm going to tell the mayor, one. Those 5 men were killed by experts. How do we know? They left no clues or casualties behind. They could have been white. They could have been black. We don't know. I think the idiot is smart enough to accept that and use it to get off the hook. But if he presses the point, I'm going to tell him that everything points to white. Black men don't kill that way. Not when they're killing each other. I never saw a black killing that wasn't crime of one passion or another. This wasn't. This is a goddamn massacre, and the closing of a trap as only a white man would do. Second, I'll tell him Buford was the only logical target of the assassination. Those 5 people were all tied to him. There was no reason to kill them except that they meant Buford. What he has, then, is a white attack on the most inflammatory and vital of the black militant leadership. Is he prepared for that? Is he going to tell the city that? God knows. The commissioner spun around and flung himself up the stairs towards the entrance, where a uniformed cop stood guard and now raised his hand in salute. Andreazzi followed, thinking about the mafia. He remembered the confidential report that had circulated after Watts about the insurance policies on those charred slums. There was a trace of olive oil in the smoke. Nobody could tell how much, but here? What was the bridge in Shaft's mind that went from a black nationalist gun battle to the mob? Cars were moving out of the parking spaces and the underground garages of the apartments at 735. Good, thick darkness was settling on Riverdale with the sun disappearing behind the Palisades in Jersey across the Hudson. The cars would be carrying couples down the West Side Highway, past the glimmering reflection on the river of the Palisades amusement park, and the Crisco sign that were New Jersey's contribution to the River View. Riverdale was heading for the theater, some of it to catch a quick dinner first, but most to struggle with the hunt for a parking place. There were a lot of them making that trip, the intense young people who spoke of theater but went to musicals. At 7:35, a black Cadillac limousine slipped into the Riverdale street of Marvin Green's apartment, found a door marked service entrance behind a row of shrubs, and paused there with the engine breathing lightly. Two figures moved out of the confusion of landscape gardening down the walk and folded themselves into the back seat. The vehicle moved away as soon as the door clicked shut, and Shaft settled back against the cushion at Ben Buford's side, thinking that these big cars were as warm and soft as an upholstered pussy. "Be a mighty surprised chauffeur if we got into the wrong car," he said, nodding towards the dark-skinned, uniformed driver who was pretending not to be checking them out in the rearview mirror. Buford grunted. There had been little time for them to talk in the afternoon, and the nationalist leader had shown no eagerness to seek conversation. He had seemed disoriented, jarred loose from the firm foundation of his ego by the echoes of machine gun rattles that were now vibrating through the city. Shaft had been through with his telephone calls and was back in the kitchen talking with Helen Green when Buford came out of the children's bedroom. Helen was just then suggesting that Shaft should get married and move to the suburbs. He had been suggesting in return that she take up skydiving as a hobby. "He would if she would," he said, but they were both too young to die. She threw a potato at him. He caught it, and they laughed, a spatter of chuckles that drowned out the first wave of Buford's gloomy presence. Shaft's glance at the tall man was speculative, measuring. Helen asked, "Did you sleep all right, curled up in that bed?" "Yes," Buford said. "Here, have a cup of coffee." "I'll get it," Shaft said, moving to the cupboard for a cup, then to the stove. "You want milk and sugar?" "Yes." "Yes, please, you son of a bitch," Shaft thought. "That bastard must think the world's nothing but a bunch of white coeds hungry for the punishment of his fire, ready to wait on him." He put the cup down at a place on the table, the coffee black. "Milk's in the icebox," he said. "God damn it, pour it in your ear for all I care," he thought. Helen said she would get it for Ben, to sit down and wake up. Buford sat. Shaft thought he looked like a big skinny bug in a museum exhibit, without his jacket on, and the gold-rimmed spectacles glittering a reflection of the kitchen lights, all antenna and elbows, like a praying mantis that had been trained to wear a turtleneck. Shaft's mind began to run away with the images. It wasn't his kind of thinking, but he was enjoying it, pouring out a secret or maybe not so secret resentment on the one-time friend of the streets. Then he pulled himself up short with a question that must have come from the last shred of his conscience, poking through to his overriding sense of reality. Why did he dislike Buford now? For going his own route? For doing more than he had done or ever considered doing about the black identity they shared? Buford may have sensed the vulnerability of Shaft's self-examination. He chose the moment to ask. "How many people did I lose?" "5, Shaft said. The numerals scraped and grated on his throat, coming out ragged and choked. "Jesus Christ." That was it. Dots, Pierce, and Newfield on the roof, 2 downstairs. The big, hard face behind the spectacles was blank with the pain of it. then turned down to the coffee. That was it. They were Buford's people, not his. Shaft thought that if he had been anybody else but the thing he had become, he would walk across the kitchen, put his arms around Ben Buford, and weep with the man for their brothers. Instead, he offered the cold half inch of reality.
I want you to go with me this evening, Ben, to see a man who knows some answers about how and why. Buford nodded and was silent, as he sat silent now in the car, scanning the river and the Jersey shoreline, and the liners berthed the piers for freight or the fat cargo of spring's tourists. As he had been silent through the dinner with Marvin Green, his wife and children, as he might remain silent until he found the podium and the audience of his hatred for the voice of his violence. Shaft lit another cigarette. He had bummed a pack of Salems from Helen. He dropped the match in an ashtray that was bigger than the radio in most cars and told Buford something of the story of Beatrice and how he was trying to find her. It was the first chance he'd had. But was Ben listening? He couldn't tell. The Cadillac suddenly, quietly, pulled up in front of Knox Pearson's castle. He wanted Buford to go in carrying the knowledge that this little bitch he'd never seen, not John Shaft, was the cause of 6 deaths so far. Maybe a lot more to come.
6. If we do not have the capacity to deal with these problems today, and the courage for a confrontation with our mistakes of the past, then we might as well abandon this city to the chaos that will befall it. I cannot let this happen, either as your mayor or as a citizen of a metropolis that is great in all things, even its sorrow over these tragic, shameful, wasteful deaths. Nor can you permit this to happen if you hope to live in peace, in the assurance that we are not plunging headlong toward an irretrievable condition of despair and disruption. Therefore, as your mayor, I propose.
Knox Persons flicked a button on the television control panel. The big blue eye in the wall went dark. He touched another control, and a brow of wood and matching fabric panel drooped over it, settling on bearings in the wall and hid its presence. He rubbed the ash off the even-burning end of his cigar in his left fist and raised it from the big crystal ashtray to his lips. He thought about the mayor, what they forgot after they got there to being mayor and things like that, was where they'd come from, what the city meant and how it worked. They used to know. He remembered men who knew and made it work. They paid their dues. They used it. Some good, some bad, but they knew. This one didn't know, except how to look on the box on the wall. Too many of them only knew that. Nothing more. Too many of the young ones knew how to look, how to talk, but they didn't know how anything worked. These were Knox Person's thoughts when the soft summons of the telephone twisted his huge body around at the vertical leather bathtub and informed him that Shaft was there with Ben Buford. Shaft. Did he know? He had to gamble that Shaft did, but there was doubt in that gamble. Maybe they hadn't let Shaft know enough as he went into their world. Maybe just enough to get by until he got himself killed. Maybe until they decided to kill him off. A touch of fear and remorse penetrated the hulk of him. Beatrice. God damn those motherfuckers. Let them give Shaft enough life to find her. They'd kill him, sure. But let him find her first. They'd kill him, sure. That was how things worked. Didn't have anything to do with the bright blue faces on the wall. Knox, this is Ben Buford, Shaft said as he came through the door at the far end of the room and waded through the pool of white carpeting. Knox nodded at the tall beige bag of angles and degrees. He didn't get up or offer his hand. Buford wasn't bending either. He silently assessed the big black man through the shimmering ovals of the wire-bound spectacles, then granted a nod in return. Hey, Shaft thought, these bastards really picked up on each other fast. They were so goddamn cool, but their minds were tearing at each other, ripping and smashing at each other like a couple of studs hungry for the same woman. Power was the woman, and they were both after her. He caught Person's almost imperceptible gesture toward the 2 chairs that had been set in front of the glass desk. He also caught Buford's vibrations of hostility. Shit. They weren't going to talk to each other. Not unless he forced it. He didn't give a fuck if Persons reached right over that glass lake and pinched Buford's head off with two big fat fingers. And he didn't give a good goddamn if Buford sank his teeth into the meaty column of brown flesh that rose like a bridge abutment out of Knox's frosty white shirt. But he wasn't going to get killed simply because he was caught between them. "This cat knows where Beatrice is," he said blandly, pointing a thumb at Ben, watching the bomb land on both of them, flare in the sudden ignition of shock, then blossom into a cloud of rage. He was watching it happen to Persons when Buford hit him. Stupid. He had underestimated the black nationalist. The long, lean body struck him in the side of the head like a screaming spear from a catapult hidden in the forest of the white rug. A spear screaming, "You son of a bitch!" And with all the ugly thunder of Buford's anger, surprise, and outrage, the left side of Shaft's head went numb under the impact. He felt himself lifted out of the chair, spinning to the right. He tried his feet, and they weren't there. They were going out sideways, kicking at nothing. Shaft had a sliding, blurred image of Persons getting out of the leather bathtub with more speed than his bulk allowed. But he lost the focus in the spinning room. He had deliberately unleashed a maniac upon himself, and he had about a half a second to get ready for the consequences. He pulled his body together as tightly as possible and twisted to the land, rolling on his left shoulder. "Come on, Persons, get your ass around there and grab this mad bastard." Buford remembered the streets. He didn't stand there and weigh the damage of his blow and the satisfaction of it. He was right with Shaft all the way, on top of him, around him, the angles and points of his body flying in quick squall of blows, hurtling toward the carpet. Shaft thought he'd be going right through the floor into the hammering if Buford had 40 or 50 more pounds of flesh to spend on his rage. He pulled up a knee to cover his groin and threw his right arm in front of his face to push when he landed and to cover his chin and eyes. He held the left close to his side, feeling rather than thinking that he would throw it once into the center of Buford's storm. He didn't want to hurt him, just bring him under control now. He hit the carpeting, twisted. All right, now. He swung. Nothing. The fist sliced through empty air and filled the vacuum of Buford's sudden absence. Persons had him. That was power, Shaft thought, the big, ham-big hands, holding Buford by the arms but containing the entire writhing length of the man in a double vise. The strength of the grip went all the way down through the hard core of Person's bulk. Shaft lay on the floor for a moment, watching Buford lash and lunge like a marionette hanging on steel strings. Buford's glasses had twisted off in the fray. He looked about 5 years younger and a lot dumber. A foot lashed out and caught Shaft in the hard muscle of the calf of his left leg. That son of a bitch had the longest legs in the world. He was screaming out of his mind. "I'll kill you, you rotten faggot cocksucker," Buford shouted. That was the language he wanted to hear from Buford. Down to the basics. Never mind all that revolution shit. This was the only level where he would get what he wanted from Buford. Shaft started getting off the floor, careful to stay out of range of the big flying feet. "Fuck you," he shouted at Buford. Persons was bellowing too. "Stop it, goddammit!" Good. Persons was mad too. Beneath that ton of lard and muscle, there was a place where it was possible to get to Persons. Shaft let them roar. It was doing them all good. Buford was raging out of an almost catatonic blankness that had cloaked his reaction since the shooting and the flight to Marvin Green's apartment. Persons was forced to feel and react with more than his massive imperturbability. A man forced to deal with a dogfight in the middle of his carpet. And he, Shaft, was in control. There was a moment's lull, as there is in the eye of a hurricane, a dead dramatic calm. He used it to pull the still unopened envelope of Knox Persons' money out of his jacket and throw it down on the glass desk. Persons and Buford were ludicrous figures, standing before him in a dance of lunge and restraint. It was an outrageous gesture. Shaft was slightly apprehensive himself. He wondered with a twinge if he would ever get his hands on that envelope again. It depended on how they reacted next, these two angry black men, who were so distinctly apart from both his own anger and his own blackness. "I am going to get the fuck out of here and let you two eat each other," he snarled. "You, you son of a bitch," he leveled a finger to Buford, "are the biggest goddamn phony in the world. Revolution, my ass. You just found a new way to chase pussy. How much homework you ever done? How many dues you pay? Shit, you just found something to do besides go to jail for being stupid.
4 o'clock this morning, some cats came around to show you just how much you didn't know. He had to cut deep to get to the core of Buford and split him open. He hoped Persons was hanging on. There'll be statues of you all over Mississippi one of these days, with big letters all over them saying, "This here is the nigger who led the sheep to slaughter." His eyes burned into Buford's with every word. He had not looked at Persons. Now he did, saying in a softer, slower voice, "And you, you're worse. He's a crazy Judas, but you got maybe a couple $1,000 in the bank for every piece of brain and bone that's sprayed around on that roof. You got the silver, yeah. You got the silver, and you'd lie every goddamn one of us into hell for more of it, including your own daughter, including every black man in the world." Shaft turned and strode toward the door. He wasn't sure he could get out of the building alive, but he wasn't going to act like he couldn't. Halfway across the room, he stopped to finish it. "You know what I mean?" he asked, turning to them, noting that Persons no longer held Buford, that they simply stood there watching him. "I mean neither one of you bastards is worth a damn to me, to the black people, to Beatrice, wherever the hell she is right now." He turned and left them. There were the men outside the door. They looked at him but said nothing. Shaft walked evenly but not quickly along the gleaming oak-paneled hallway to the elevator door. The black plastic button was set in a brass plate. Or maybe it was gold. Christ, Persons could have a platinum elevator if he wanted. On the edge of his peripheral vision, Shaft was watching the 2 men at the gates to Knox's sanctuary. He pushed the black button with a fat thumb and heard the machinery of the small lift begin to whir. He was counting. He was up to 120. 121, 122. The guards at the door stiffened slightly, their slouching suits rising out of the creases of inactivity. The door opened. Shaft concentrated on the elevator button.
"Shaft,"
Persons rumbled at him. He turned his grim face to the man whose bulk filled the doorway. The guards also looked at Persons, their faithful eyes wanting to know if they should run retrieve Shaft like a stick on the beach, a ball in the field. Persons ignored them. So did Shaft.
"You want to come back and talk this out?"
Shaft looked at him with what he hoped to be disdain, or at least indifference. "What?" He pretended deafness.
"You won't come back here and talk a little?"
He had the bastards. It was in the pause, in the modification of the request. He probably had Buford, too. He would have paid $100 for the transcript of the conversation that followed his departure from the room. The 120-second exchange, spoken or shouted, in which the two of them had decided that the bullshit was over and they would now get down to it with Shaft, provided Shaft could be brought back to do it. "Straight?" Shaft asked. The guards at the door must be wigging over the dialogue. They had probably never heard Persons involved in an equal exchange. He got reports and gave orders. Who was this cat in the rumpled gray suit, torn out at the shoulder a little, who was treating Knox Persons like something else? "Straight?" Shaft asked. Were they going to level? There was no alternative now. They had forced him into the position and had to accept it.
"Straight,"
Knox promised, reaching into a back pocket for the handkerchief about the size of a schooner's sail, dabbing at the perspiration across his heavy brow. The elevator door hissed aside. Shaft glanced from Persons to the small chamber that would carry him down to the street, and he knew now that he could make the journey without interference, and then look back to Persons, waiting. Let the man take one more measure of the importance of his decision. "Straight," he repeated, turning back toward the room, again walking evenly, but not quickly. Ben Buford had apparently picked up the chrome and leather side chairs that they had knocked over in the outburst and was sitting slumped into one of them, gnawing on the knuckle of his left thumb. His right hand was resting on his thigh, and the fingers diddling nervously in a rippling drumbeat of anxiety or exasperation. He didn't look up. Shaft took the chair beside Buford. Persons immersed himself in the leather bathtub.
"What do you want?"
the big man grumbled. The envelope of money still lay on the glass. It had not been moved from the spot where Shaft dropped it. The question was implicit with Persons. Did he want more money? Shaft ignored the nuance of the substance of the moment. Of course he wanted more money. He wanted money and money and money. But there was a line he had to draw for them. "Two things," Shaft said. "From you, I want to know who the hell is after you and why. From him, he turned his head to nod at Buford, I want straight answers on what he's after as far as you're concerned and what he's willing to do to get it. You first. Where's your trouble? Persons had more guts than the rhino he resembled.
Heroin, he said matter-of-factly. Spanish Harlem, over around 116th Street and Broadway.
Why there? That's all over. Persons seemed almost to be smiling at his ignorance.
About 7 or 8 years ago, the Italians decided to let the retail business go. There was all this pot and pill shit going on. Everybody was pushing. It was like a kid in school didn't have to go look for a pusher in the playground. He'd just go to his teacher and make the connection. It was all amateurs. Everybody was doing it. Everybody was the pusher. Everybody was the connection. Everybody was the user. What's that got to do with heroin?
Well, it was all confused. It got so nobody could keep track of what was going on, coming in, going out. All like that. Everybody was carrying. So the Italians, they decided it was too much for them to keep track of. They couldn't do it.
Why not? They always kept track of it before.
That was before. They had people, lots of people, the young ones to train and move in with them. Where are the young ones now? They going to some college. They going into the real estate business. They going and keeping track of the books and the figures instead of the pushers and the heads.
Of course, Shaft thought. If a mafia don was breaking his kid into the business today, he would break him in through the Harvard Business School rather than the college of the streets.
Instead, Persons went on, warming to his lecture, they figure they just let the small stuff go to the Spanish coming in, the Cubans and the Puerto Ricans, and they just get theirs in moving it in and out of the country.
So what's that mean in trouble for you?
It means, Buford interjected in his angry, preachy voice, that the Cubans and the Puerto Ricans didn't get a goddamn thing. He did.
Buford meant Persons. You took over heroin in Spanish Harlem? Shaft asked. Persons gazed silently at them for a moment, then nodded. What's the difference? Shaft persisted. Again, it was Buford who answered.
About $8-10 million a year, the way he took it and expanded it. That's the guess. Only he can tell you for sure.
It was funny as hell to Shaft. Only he couldn't laugh just yet. The mafia had gotten out of the Spanish Harlem heroin trade because it was suffering from a personnel shortage. They thought they were throwing a scrap to the Spics who could be controlled at the sources. But it didn't work that way. Crime, profit, basic to nature, won't tolerate the vacuum either. Persons had moved in. It was very funny. He had probably even absorbed the Spaniards without much difficulty. What the hell? Half of them were black, and getting blacker through the integration of poverty and ghetto isolation. The Italians were no longer the lower class of crime, at least on that level. They were the aristocracy. He supposed Andreozzi knew all this. Why hadn't he mentioned it? Was he so busy looking for angry niggers under the beds with Molotovs that he was forgetting the basics? That wasn't likely. The son of a bitch just wasn't leveling with him. His thoughts turned swiftly back to the money, the prize of this game. $8 to $10 million, Shaft said. Persons may have considered trying to get away from the economics of it, but he couldn't get away from Buford.
You don't count it that way, Knox said.
The hell you don't, Ben said, straightening up in the chair. You count every goddamn penny of it.
Hey, man, Shaft said. No speeches. Buford twisted and looked at him for the first time since he had tried to smash Shaft's head from its moorings. The insane eyes were lighted anew with anger, but his voice was controlled and even.
Maybe you need speeches, Shaft, he said. Maybe you should listen sometime to what's happening. What that son of a bitch is saying is that he controls the source of more fucking misery for the black people of Harlem than Whitey ever dreamed of holding.
Shaft couldn't help himself. What's the matter with you, fool? Don't you believe in equal opportunity?
One day, Buford said, it's going to be a crime for a son of a bitch like you to call himself black. For you, for him, for everybody else who stands for and with the corruption of the community. You are going to see the day when a black man doesn't suck the blood of his brother and give it back in junk and gin and drive his Cadillacs on the difference in the price. You are going to see,
oh, for Christ's sakes. Shaft tried to protest. Buford rode right over it.
Not for Christ's sake, but for the brother's sake. If we have to destroy every motherfucker in the world like that pig over there, or a half-honky pimp like you who doesn't give a shit about anything but himself, I want to be there when they throw your body on the fire.
You'll never see it, Shaft said.
I'll see it. We'll all see it because the whole goddamn country will be burning down. Well, good, Shaft shouted.
Buford had climbed half out of the chair to bellow at him. He was poised now in a crouch that made him seem about to leap toward the sky where he could grasp thunderbolts to hurl down at these infidels.
Well, good. At least I know how crazy you are. Before, I only suspected.
He turned to the imperturbable mass of Knox persons. Now we both know where this is all at, he said. I figured you knew all the time. I hope you know this cat wasn't talking to me. That was for you.
I can say for myself who I am talking to, Buford snapped.
Shut up, Shaft ordered. There was finality in it, the threat that the conversation would either go Shaft's direction or end in sudden, swift violence.
Buford's mouth opened slightly, then closed. Shaft was angry, not at Ben or anything stirred by Buford's rhetoric. He had been told all that before, one way or another. He was pissed off at himself for the time that had been wasted.
You heard what he said, Shaft told Persons. It ain't me he's after. It's your ass or his. You smart enough to see what he's doing?
There was no sign from Persons.
I said he knew where Beatrice was. You knew too, you dumb bastard.
7.
You can complain to the union,
he had smart-assed Persons. But $12.50 an hour is only my rate for living. I get a lot more for dying. Shaft went out of the brownstone lair with $10,000 tucked into an inside pocket of the gray suit jacket. It was 10 times more than had been in the first envelope. He had told Persons that he would expect 10,000 more when and if he could deliver. Take it or leave it. It wasn't blackmail, he thought. Just a reappraisal of the job hazards on the basis of more realistic information. For now, the hunt began. Now, he knew what he was hunting. Ben Buford walked out with him, seeming to burn less fiercely with the inner angers. He was like a dog, Shaft thought. It made him feel better to bark and snarl once in a while. Or even bite.
You want to deal with that man, Shaft told him as they walked toward the corner through the midnight mist. Now's your chance.
Shaft wished he had his raincoat. He couldn't remember where it was, the office, Androtsy's cubicle, maybe back at the apartment, or Ellie's. If anything more happened to the suit, he wouldn't be able to walk the streets in it. He dealt with a nice guy named Burke at Paul Stewart. Burke wouldn't recognize this rumpled ragbag as the child of his salesmanship, but then Burke probably wouldn't believe where the suit had been in the last 72 hours since he had gotten into it. The night traffic along Broadway was heavy. Shaft tried to think why. Thursday? The stores had been open late. People stopped to complain about the prices at Bloomingdale's. The more they complained, the more they ate. Late traffic, a lot of people with headaches. But, he went on when Buford remained silent, you can't kill him. You give some, and you take some. That's the way he lives. Buford glanced up and down the divided avenue and its collection of small dark shops. He had made 2 calls from Person's coin telephone in the closet. More men would be coming to him from the replacement depot of his underground army. It's not the way we live anymore, Buford said, without the emphasis of contention, just stating it.
Look, man, Shaft sighed. I don't want to get into this with you again. Not now. Maybe sometime, but not now. I got a job to do, and I'm going to do it. That job is to get that man's daughter back. I don't, and I can't give a shit if he sells slaves to George Wallace. I'm still going to do it, one way or the other.
He raised his arm at the advancing roof light of a cab. The turn indicator on the yellow Chevy blinked, and the driver pulled over to collect him. A black driver. Sometimes life was so simple.
I'm going to call you if I need you, Shaft said, reaching for the handle.
What if that was the CIA last night and not who you think it was?
You talk any Spanish?
A little. Why?
You better go hide your ass in Cuba if it's who you think it was.
He got in and began to pull the door shut. Then he finished with him.
I'm sorry you lost those cats. He jerked the door shut before Buford could reply, if indeed there would have been a reply.
The village, Shaft told the driver, who had screwed his head around on rolls of fat and was peering at him under a bill of a plaid cap.
Just go 9th Avenue past 14th. Why, he thought the dirty bastards had been trying to kill him just because Knox Persons had come down to Times Square with his problem and dumped it on Shaft's desk. His mind went weaving through the results and the twists of what had happened, like a little old lady doing a broken field run through the tightly packed outdoor vegetable stands the cab was passing along 9th Avenue, some of them still lighted and doing business. He marveled with a shake of his head and a wry smile into the darkness at how quickly and coolly they had set up the hit. He had been so convenient for them. They must have been watching every move Persons made since they snatched Beatrice. Knocking off his first contact would have shown Persons how helpless he was, surrounded, alone. And it could have come off as just another race thing. Schaff was certain the police thought that's what it was anyhow. He was certain they wanted to think that, rather than pry up the lid on the sewer that ran even lower than the one through which they had to swim each day. What if Buford's people hadn't been standing in the doorways with machine guns under their raincoats? Screw what if questions, he told himself. It's strictly what is in this goddamn world. You better know it. The world took what if questions apart, made you eat them. The cab went past 22nd, Ellie Street. He hadn't even called her. She would be going to bed now. He wanted to tell the silent, hunched driver to swing down the block, let him off so he could crawl between the soft, smooth sheets with her, let her smooth, soft legs intertwine with his as they curled together to sleep. For all he knew, the bastards were sitting outside her apartment now, waiting to take off the top of his head with a shotgun. Shit. Why did he torture himself this way? His life was on the line, and he was thinking about some fox. It didn't matter what he wanted at the moment. The job was finding out what they wanted in exchange for Beatrice. There was a progressive scale of greed to the rackets. Maybe, like Ben Buford, they wanted all of Persons. White or black, somebody always had. When the cab ran out of 9th Avenue and it became Hudson Street, the driver announced, "Here's 14th. Just keep going. Three or four more blocks." The meatpacking warehouses were dull globs of inactivity in the night. In a few hours, they'd light up and bring the West Village to life, getting the stiff, fat-caked carcasses off the hooks and out to the butchers and big restaurants. This part of the village was like a suburb of the Bag of Worms, squirming over where Bleecker ran into 6th and went on down to Sullivan, McDougal, Thompson, and the bullshit carnival. It was close enough, but quiet enough. Now it might be too quiet. "The street after the next light," he said. "Jane Street. Turn there. I'll get off on the corner on the next block." Jane Street. He glanced at his apartment building on the corner, a white-painted four-story brick building that went two apartments deep into Jane toward 8th Avenue, but halfway down the block of Hudson Street. His eyes went automatically to the windows of his own apartment in the third-floor corner. Had he left the blinds closed? They were closed now. He usually did that, but sometimes he didn't. He liked to walk around without clothes, getting coffee, ducking into the shower, shaving, getting another cup of coffee. But it had been so long since he'd been there. He occasionally flicked the blinds open before he left so he wouldn't be coming back to a dark, gloomy cave. But he couldn't remember. The driver made the right on Jane Street, around the entrance to the Cezanne apartments, one of the big red brick clusters where girls with roommates, fags with roommates, young couples with dogs as roommates find refuge, with laundry facilities in the basement. The orange globes around the entrance to the no-name bar opposite his building leered at the street like jack-o'-lantern teeth. They might be sitting in there watching his apartment, waiting for the light to go on. He hoped so. There were so many freaks in that joint, they'd drive a couple of ordinary half-sane assassins right up the wall. The music pounding at them, the drunken broads babbling at them, the bummy writers insisting on telling them what they almost wrote that day and might try tomorrow. Schaff tipped a quarter on the $1.45 fare and stepped into the cool, wet air of the night. It was nearly 1 o'clock. He shrugged against the slight chill that penetrated the suit. Spring pissed around forever getting to New York, and suddenly it was summer. Long, hot summer. He thought he would get an air conditioner this year. Knox Persons would buy him a piece of cool. He glanced up and down Jane Street. The Volkswagens were snugged in, nose to tail with the Triumphs and Fiats, long rows of oddly shaped dogs exchanging introductions. To the best of his eyes, there was nobody around or near the entrance to his place. But who was sitting in the cars or leaning in an entryway? or up there behind the Venetian blinds in his apartment. He stood at the side door of the no-name for a few moments, thinking of the odds for and against them wanting to take him here. The nice thing about dealing with pure bastards, he thought, is they didn't waste a lot of time getting between points. They wanted him dead, they'd get him dead, and they would do it at a time and a place that was most efficient, at least troublemaking for them. It might seem circuitous or illogical to others, but to them, it would be direct. Nothing to it, Shaft, he told himself. All you got to do is put yourself in some crazy guinea head, walk around the scorched hills of Sicily for 100 years on your way to Spanish Harlem and figure out how and why you want to kill John Shaft, a previously unheard-of spade who's screwing around with the nice orderly process of organized crime. Then, he let the thought ramble, you come back into the head of John Shaft and figure out how you get to them before they get to you. Balls, he muttered, moving to go into the no-name, opening the side door a slice. Let the blast of words and warmth riding over the jukebox rock splash against his face with surf smells of alcohol and bodies. He hoped a couple of them would be sitting at the far corner of the bar, watching his apartment. It would make it so much simpler to get in touch with them. They were there, all right. Two of them. Shaft's blackness against a white world was less contrast than their dark evil against the light mood of the drinkers. These had to be the bottom of the barrel, he thought. He figured if those bastards were going to have somebody hit, they sent to Detroit or St. Louis for a couple of salesman-looking executioners who got into your life, did the job of closing it, and then got out as smoothly as precision parts in a great low-tolerance machine. He acknowledged that this was another cliché, that the two men at the front of the bar could survive as clichés in a society with great traditions of violence, and that he might die of its overworked application. The bar in the no-name runs about 30 feet from back to front, makes a slight elbow to the right and ends there against a dark oak-paneled wall about 4 feet from the window. They had the end seats, looking out into Hudson Street, up onto the windows of Shaft's kitchen, living room, and bedroom on the third floor. The fire escape went right past the living room window. The front door to the building was in clear view just around the corner on Jane Street. That was the advantage for people like this. Architects designed the world so killers could sit like fat toads waiting for the next meal to fly by. Zap! The sticky tongue shot out. Blip! The meal was over. Shaft thought they looked like toads, too. But he wasn't a mosquito straying out of formation. He started to slip off his suit jacket as he moved into the crowd. They were about 30 or 35, he thought. Old enough to know the business. Tough enough to have survived in it. Dumb enough to still be taking orders for things like this. He jostled against a threesome of two fat girls oozing out of miniskirts and a seedy young guy in tweeds. Everybody in the West Village looked like a writer. Few of them ever wrote anything except bad checks. But fat girls never complained about bad checks from seedy-looking writers. There were four big black men bunched around a small blonde chick at the near end of the bar where the drop-leaf panel lifted and gave the bartender a way to get in and out. Whoever it was, he had to come around about 3 times on an average no-name night and throw somebody into Hudson Street, that somebody protesting that he'd never be back to drink in that lousy goddamn joint ever again, until tomorrow. The black cats would never make out, Shaft thought, as willing as the chick probably was. They still needed the security of numbers in that great pussy hunt when it was a lonely stalker who invariably found the game. Raleigh Nickerson, a tall, skinny actor who was usually stoned out of his skull, was working behind the bar, long, spidery arm shooting out like exploding pistons to grab a bottle, swipe the bar, plunge a glass, and scoop up ice. Probably on speed. The amphetamines hammering energy out of him and burning up his brain cells. The bartenders at the No Name were either frantically busy or just standing there stone, smiling into the pleading eyes of the customers. Nobody complained. If it got too bad, they just went up Jane Street to the bistro or down Hudson to the White Horse. It was part of the circuit. The man was entitled to get stoned. Shaft pushed against the crowd, rolling up his sleeves over the heavily veined and muscular forearms. His inspection bounced back and forth from Nickerson to the two men at the end of the bar, and everybody else in the joint. There were people there who knew him well enough to call his name, to turn to the men and say, "There's Shaft, the guy you've been..." But those two couldn't be dumb enough to tie themselves to the name of a man they planned to knock off. He had to play it strong anyhow. He got the envelope of cash out of the jacket pocket, opened it close to his face like a poker player trying to squeeze aces out of a queen's ear.
The bills were so damn big. He had to hunt for 50s. Finally found a couple and palmed them out of the envelope before stuffing the package into his left rear pants pocket. He pushed into the cluster of black cats surrounding the giggling white chick. He recognized at least one of them as being from the neighborhood. The others were strangers, and they frowned with hostility on his intrusion. There may be security and confidence in numbers, but who was this son of a bitch come to play in their game? "It's cool," he said to the one he recognized, probably a super from one of the big buildings somewhere around there. Shaft handed him his coat, the tie now pushed into a side pocket. "Hold this a minute, will you?" The man was smashed enough to take the coat without making a big thing out of it. He wore a beret pulled down over his right ear. "Who are you going to fight?" he asked. "Gotta get to work," Shaft said, moving toward the panel that led behind the bar. The others relaxed. Shit, the man wasn't after the woman. He just had to work. They smiled. "I'll take it from you when I clean up a place to put it."
"It looked like a good coat," Drunk said. "If I get $3-4 for it, I may not be here."
The others laughed. So did Shaft. He didn't feel it, but he laughed, still keeping track of Raleigh Nickerson and the far end of the bar.
"That's all good," he said. "But we can get to the cat I stole it from. Don't ask for more than 4.
Everybody except the blonde chick thought it was funny. She seemed threatened by his confidence, glibness. She kept her pink nose and some gin drink she was sucking on. The black men around her stood aside as Shaft moved to the small panel, lifted it, and stepped behind the bar. Now all he needed was for some fool to shout, "Hey, Shaft, you the new bartender? How about a drink?" But they were pretty cool, drunk or stone. So was Raleigh Nickerson. Shaft was counting on the cool with his life. Nickerson was bending over the tub of ice cubes beneath the bar and caught the intrusion with the corner of his eye. He looked up, puzzled, the back of his head to the men at the end of the bar, and, recognizing Shaft, smiled. Shaft nodded. The men at the end of the bar hardly noticed. Shaft was just another spade who had come out of a cluster of spades, just another bartender. They didn't tap him for the spade. He had business there, or he wouldn't be there. Their man didn't. Shaft started straightening bottles at the end of the bar, asked the group of black men and the blonde chick if they wanted another drink.
"You buy a round, I'll give you back your coat."
"Sure, what are you drinking?" Nickerson was coming his way now, but still cool. Shaft turned and extended his hand in greeting. Nickerson went along with that. His expression changed when the 250s found a new home. He glanced down, saw the numerals at the corner of the green wad, and moved the message casually into his pocket. "Why don't you go around to the other side and have a drink?" Shaft said.
"You just bought yourself a saloon," Nickerson agreed,
giving him a familiar slap on the shoulder as he began to move past Shaft to the exit. He should give a shit. For $100, he could get a cut-rate dentist to start capping his teeth. With a mouthful of glittery, Christ, he could be a star. The owner didn't come around until 3 or 4 to count the money and lock up. All he had to do was back Shaft's play, whatever it was. "What's the heat?" Shaft asked. Nickerson paused. A few months earlier, at the height of the Christmas saloon robbery season, he had shown Shaft the snub-nosed .38 Colt that hung by its trigger guard on a small hook screwed into the underside of the bar. He'd even asked Shaft, as a detective, what he should do if and when it came time for some random hood to knock off the register. "Forget you got it," Shaft said. "Be nice, smile, give the man all the money." He had pushed it back across the bar, and Nickerson had returned it to the hook, gingerly and respectfully. "Same place," he said, "now. I never touched the stuff." Nickerson went on around the corner into the small, noisy clusters. Shaft went to work. He bought a drink for the 4 black men and the blonde chick. She was drinking vodka, not gin. All the blondes were drinking vodka this year, he thought. He poured about 3 shots into her highball glass and a dollop of tonic water. Somebody was going to carry her home. He didn't care who. He spent more time than he should have with them. He wanted the men at the end of the bar to notice him, to identify him with the blacks. It was the best and oldest black camouflage. They all looked alike. The gunmen were looking for one who looked different and would show himself by turning up at the apartment across the street. Shaft checked them out whenever his head was turned in that direction, on the way to the ice cubes or the register. They were sitting, smoking, occasionally, touching the glasses in front of them, but barely drinking. They apparently accepted the change in shifts and the new bartender as a matter of course. They were unfamiliar with the bar's operation. So was Shaft. He hadn't spent that much time there. The register, the
the goddamned register. It was a complex, curious collection of keys. He remembered quickly that the black bar down the side was the one the bartender hit with the heel of his hand after punching out the price of the drinks. He hit it, and the drawer sprang open. "Leave the motherfucker open," he told himself. "Give us a couple of beers, will you?" He gave the voice a couple of beers. He was falling into the rhythm of the work. God damn, look at those mugs of beer. Perfect. It made him thirsty for a glass of beer until he remembered that he didn't like beer. He was thirsty for the perfection of drawing it. He grabbed a mug from the cluster of them beneath the bar and drew one. Perfect. Then he didn't know what to do with it. He looked up for a beer drinker, put the mug in front of him, and said, "Have one on the house." There was a sense of completion in the act of selling a commodity for which the demand seemed endless. That's why bartenders always looked so happy. For all the pains in the ass that alcohol inspired, the man who served it was always in demand. He identified with the product. Shaft got a small chaser glass off the drying towels, hunted up a quart of Johnny Walker Black Label on the high shelf in front of the mirror. He poured an inch of amber into it, raised it, and let the golden heat roll down his throat. A toast to nobody. A toast to himself. He was beginning to sweat lightly, and that felt good, too. The phone rang. It startled him, coming so clearly through the noise of the jukebox and the drinkers. The phone was set under the bar, down at the end where the hoods were sitting. He finished squeezing a lime into the quinine water of a tired gin drinker and went down to it. The two men looked up at him. Shaft pointed at their glasses. "You ready?" "Not yet," the older one said. Shaft reached the phone out of its nook with one hand and held it to his ear. He smiled at the men. They smiled back at him. "No name," he said. "Is Alex Palmer there?" a querulous, unhappy voice asked. How did anybody in that condition dial a telephone? He held the mouthpiece away from his lips. "The one of you guys named Alex Palmer?" he asked. Their faces were blank, and they shook their heads. Shaft turned away from them and pretended to scan the room. "Not here," he said into the phone. "Look, if she comes in, will you tell her to call?" The name was a mumble. "Sure," Shaft said. "I'll tell her." He hung up. He enjoyed the feeling of standing close to the men. How does a tiger in the bush feel when the hunter stands 2 feet away lighting a cigarette, studying the tracks? A little excited, a little nervous, confident, in control. He felt confident, in control. If they knew who he was, they were as cool as he was. They had a system, and they didn't vary it. One of them was always looking out the window, seemingly casual and bored. When he turned back to the bar, the other was automatically turning to look out and maintain the unbroken vigil. They didn't speak to each other much, or monosyllables that he couldn't catch. He caught up with the demand at the bar, noticed that the crowd was thinning out. They were all really 9-to-5ers at heart. It was almost 2 o'clock, and they had to get up in the morning and put on their straight office clothes and go to work. It was bad enough just being alive. They couldn't get bombed every night to boot, although a lot of them tried. The phone, a wonderful phone. He went back to the end of the bar. "Ready yet?" he asked them. "Sure," said the one in the houndstooth sports jacket over a red polo shirt. "Club and water, both of them." The other one looked like a businessman, Shaft thought, as he got a bottle of Canadian Club and poured out the shots. He wore a dark sharkskin suit with a white shirt and narrowish tie with a small pattern. Just a couple of guys having a couple of drinks. He dropped fresh ice cubes into their glasses, tipped the shots in after them, and added water from a small pitcher. He suddenly remembered that he didn't know how much they had been paying a shot for the drinks. He could fake it with the rest of the customers, but not with these two. "The house buys one," Shaft said, getting another chaser glass in the Johnny Walker bottle. He poured an inch and a half in the glass and raised it in a toast. "Drink with me, you motherfuckers," his mind roared. They raised their glasses in a toast and sipped with him. "Thanks," said the sports coat. "Sure," said Shaft. "Happy days." The liquor felt warm, strong, and positive as it drifted into his stomach. They didn't know who he was, and they were beginning to love him. Shaft smiled. They smiled. He bent down under the bar and reached for the telephone. There was the 38 dangling in a dull blue-black gleam like the head of a snake from a vine. It was as warming and confidence-giving as the scotch. He smiled at the gun. He could swear the muzzle smiled back. Shaft made one more circuit of the bar. Raleigh Nickerson came giggling away from one of the tables along the wall where he had found a couple of girls without men. Three vodkas and tonic, my good man, he ordered. Your ass, Shaft said. I'm your worst man. Hey, you ever hear the Jelly Roll Morton stuff where he tells Lomax how the old studs used to put each other down? I got those records, man, Shaft said, pouring vodka into the three glasses, splashing tonic down on them and hunting around for a lime. Sure, he had those records. Anybody who knew anything about music and black men had them. Jelly Roll sitting there at the piano telling Lomax what it was like in New Orleans and all those other places. Jelly's foot tapping, his voice grinding gravel for the tape. Nickerson meant the scene where Jelly tells how a confrontation was built on a crescendo of threats and outrageous warnings. It was funky, old-fashioned nigger talk that Lomax made part of history by recording for the Library of Congress. Shaft cried when he read Lomax's book years ago. Somebody at NYU turned him onto it. He laughed when he heard the records. Jelly Roll, so fucking proud and beautiful, finally stabbed to death in a Washington, D.C. bar by some other cat. Argument over a woman. That was a good way for Jelly Roll to die. The only way. He got a bottle of Johnny Walker and poured himself another drink and poured a shot of straight vodka for Nickerson. Jelly Roll, Shaft toasted. Jelly Roll, Nickerson chimed, looking glazed and vague. He put the empty glass back down on the bar. How long do you want to stay back there? I don't know, Shaft said. I may never leave. Good. You want me to pay for my drinks? Fuck it. You're a good bartender. Shaft could feel the liquor as he watched Nickerson take the three vodka tonics back to the little table. The chicks looked pretty good to him. A little chewed up around the edges, but young, real, and what the hell did he expect to find sitting around the no-name at 2 o'clock in the morning? Vogue models? Or chicks like this? Or the blonde down there with her pack of hounds in pursuit? Better these than the tight-ass chicks he ran into all day. He was part of their fantasies, scared hell out of them. Big black man with his big black. They all ran home to the mother of warm, oily bath to stretch out in the suds and play with themselves while they thought about it. It was better that way. If they tried it, that would spoil everything. It would turn out to be just another piece of ass. The fantasy was much more fun than the fact. He poured himself another shot of scotch, a little bigger than the others, raised it in a toast to tight-ass chicks, and let it funnel down his throat. Women. He turned and worked his way back up the bar, emptying ashtrays, swiping up the water circles and whiskey spills with a damp cloth. How you doing? He asked them. They were dark, heavy men, beyond the age of the racket beginners who usually got such jobs as this to prove themselves. They were professionals, he thought. Just fine, one of them said. Have another drink? Shaft insisted, setting up two extra glasses. They had barely touched the last ones. They smiled at his generosity. Easy. Checked sports coat said, gotta go easy, gotta drive home. But he said it jovially, fraternally. This was a good spade. You wouldn't see this one out starting riots, mugging people, slashing the canvas of your uncle's new Cadillac convertible. This one brought drinks. Can't drive on one wheel, Shaft said. He put a glass in the bar for himself and got the scotch bottle with the Canadian Club. His words sounded hollow in his own ears. Everybody's words sounded hollow. They were all drunk, he thought. He continued to think about women. He got the phone out from under the bar and dialed. Then he pushed the disconnect plunger down with a thumb. Wrong number. What the hell was it? He laughed, trying to remember. He was getting loaded. He remembered. Yes, she said, a voice drenched in sleep, heavy with the warmth of lost consciousness. It's me. John, where are you? Downtown, he said, slipping his hand over the mouthpiece. Remarking to the two hoods. Got to check in with these women. They get on your ass, man. You got trouble. The hoods smiled and nodded. They understood. They knew all about black men and black women. They finished their drinks in appreciation of Shaft's predicament with his black woman. Are you coming here? Ellie asked. What time is it? Oh, God, it's nearly 2. She found the illuminated clock beside the bed. Shaft envisioned her reaching out from a burial mound of sheets and blankets to grope for it with one long, slender arm white against the night. He wanted to feel the sweet touch of the hand. Darling, what is it? Just checking like you said I should. I'm going to be tied up with these people for a few hours. John, you sound like you've been drinking. Are you drunk? Hey, he winked at the men. I had a couple. I ain't drunk. Just talking business with these people. He's going to be a couple hours late, is all.
Darling, I don't understand. I'm going back to sleep. Ring the bell hard and I'll get up and let you in. She hung up.
I'll explain it all when I get there,
he said into the dead phone. Jesus, but he almost said, gets there.
All right, baby, you just get some sleep. Don't you worry.
No.
Now, you know I ain't doing nothing. Don't be sitting around there worrying yourself. Just go to bed and get some sleep, okay?
Context of white supremacy. First audio segment, Ernest Tidyman's Shaft. We will resume. We are in Chapter 7. We pick up for our second audio segment. The number to dial, 720-716-7300. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I believe last week, we've only done, this is our third session, so it's not like we got months of study on this book. And this book isn't that long. We're already getting close to the end. Part of why I picked this book, we could be hit it and quit it, as they say. But I think last week, I said, man, audience, we were talking about that. Who is this book written for? I think it might have been Henry in Chicago even. Who is this book written for? Do we think Ernest Tidyman wrote this book for other white people? Now, I say that and almost feel, you know, I am retarded greatly. Having lived through, like, Straight Outta Compton, the movie, the music, and knowing that there are throngs, millions of white people who love all of that and everything about all of that, Friday, and know all of the words to it and everything, lived through all of that. Do we think Ernest Tidyman wrote this for white readers? And then, did they make the movie for white people? Is this white people's fantasy? Sexual fantasy? The number again, 720-716-7300. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. White people have basically made, by Felicia, a racist joke, racial slur, if you will. And I'm having a difficult time, I guess, accepting, like, dang, Ernest, I'm going to take it the default. This white man wrote this for white readers. Does anybody think Ernest Tidyman, his intention was to write this book for black people? Even to do like a fake job, like, we're not going to reveal that I'm white maybe up front and just push this book out and see if black people would like it. Do people think that happened? Audience, we talk about that all the time. Who's the audience for the book and the movie? Said it wanted to, someone shared that they said Ernest Tidyman wanted to be Shaft. I'm wounded. The number again is 720-716-7300. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *61. If you would like to participate, I was able to speak with Neely Fuller Jr. today, hours before we went live. I asked him, did you know a white man wrote the book for the Shaft franchise? No. Unanimous it remains, even Mr. Fuller, not aware of that. Now, he did add, he did not think that this was a very constructive movie, that he did not like it at the time that it came out, even though he didn't know it was connected to a white person, and that he never recommends or talks about this film because he doesn't find anything constructive about it. He said he remember when he first saw it, he said it didn't take very long before he just said, I'm not feeling this at all. Like, I'm wasting my time here. I could be doing something else more constructive. And I told him it's got all this anti-sexual content and this, that, and the other. He's like, wow, I didn't even notice. And he said it may have just been because I was so disinterested in the film that I wasn't really paying attention. Many people were not, apparently. Especially, I guess, if you didn't like the film, hey, let's move on to something else. But he said that is not a surprise, he said, because I've been talking about that, getting black people into anti-sexual behavior and making that more acceptable. So he said, I'm not surprised that that would be in the middle of something that would, you know, has been so heavily promoted. But that was fascinating to speak to him about this content earlier today. Oh, I forgot the email, untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com. I will read folks who wrote in. I'm just rereading this one because I thought it was important, and then I get to new commentary from other folks who wrote in as well. This is one of our female victims of racism. She wrote in, what I find fascinating is that the author is a white man, programming the non-white people into believing that Shaft was a hero, someone which we can and should emulate. It made me think about some of the things non-white people are programmed to repeat, such as vaccine hesitancy, toxic masculinity, black people are homophobic or transphobic, but no good Dave Chappelle. The script has been written and we follow it to the letter, forgive the metaphor, without doing the proper research to see where the saying originated and why. Very important. untiljustice@gmail.com. We'll get to other folks who wrote in as well. Let's see if we have listeners who have thoughts, observations on Shaft, third installment. And we are right in line. I had to give myself a pat on the back, like right where we stopped at, the music that we opened with, Isaac Hayes, Soulville, that's what they play in the background at the No Name Bar, I believe. Like, we are right in line with – oh, it's a little bit earlier. It's when Shaft is kind of going around and he's trying to find Ben Buford. So a little bit behind. We maybe should have played it last week, but weave in some more. He had lots of great work on the soundtrack, Isaac Hayes, beyond the title track, Shaft. Let's see. Retired firefighter in Florida should be with us. I'll nab other hands as we go.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. Yeah, Soulville was my favorite song, actually the favorite song on the movie. And it was, like you said, as he was looking for Ben Buford, asking, you know, different people on the block, on the corner, up in the apartments. Actually, I think one of them was, what's the famous photographer who took a lot of...
The director of the film, Gordon Parks.
Yes, yes. He was one of the people that he questioned in that scene when Soulville... Soulville had a lot of lessons in the song in itself that Isaac Hayes put together. Isaac Hayes teamed with another black male. I just can't think of his name. If you can recall it, I would be able to identify it, but I just can't think of it right now, of that other person that was less popular. But he and Isaac Hayes had something to do with just about every writing that Isaac's name was on. This guy's name was on also, and I wouldn't be surprised if he played a part in some of the writings also. I missed last week because I was in what I call indigenous territory, the state of Oklahoma. This past week, but from what I gather, the movie, the book has already went through on what was his mission, if you will, with the gangster's daughter to retrieve her, I think. Now, the bar scene in the book seems to be somewhat different from the movie itself. The homosexual, the white homosexual, was the bartender that turned over the work to Chef. The guy, this person in the movie was a obvious homosexual. He even mentioned it when he mentioned about the white woman that was attracted to Chef. He stated somewhat. He said something to the faction of, well, you know, I can't mess with her. You know, it's not what I like, you know, that sort of thing. But she's interested in you. You know, so he said something like that in the movie, something like that in the movie. But anyway, I'm assuming that the two guys in the book, I don't know if they had the same purpose in the book as it was in the movie. The two guys who were in the movie were gangsters that was looking for Shaft. So I don't know if that was the same in the book. I tried to follow it, but I didn't do a good job of following exactly who those two people were. But that's where it is to be up to date wise. And I'll listen to somebody else talk about it. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. Got disconnected. The Barcades did some of the instrumentation with Isaac Hayes on the soundtrack. And he had, I think, employed lots of black people who worked with him in doing the composition, original composition, for the first film that came out.
The Barcades? Okay. One of my favorite groups. A lot of them got killed along with Otis Redding when the plane that they were flying in went down. Yeah.
They left some great work on the soundtrack, right on the title track, Shaft. They're on that one as well, and some of the other ones as well. And it is, you are correct, it is different in terms of the bar. It is a, like, openly, explicitly gay white man where Shaft pays him money to pretend to be bartender. And that's the moment where I say in the film, because they don't have all of this talk about fag this and queers that, they don't have all that in the movie, but they do have gay bartender, and he grabs Shaft's behind as he exits and allows Shaft to work the bar. Shaft doesn't say anything about this. So that's obviously switched around. And then they don't have all these people, all these characters, the four black guys and the white woman and all that. That is totally different in the movie. And Chaff having all this interplay with them. He talks to the white gangsters. That's the same. The two white guys in the book, exactly as in the movie, the gangsters that are there to keep an eye on him or to be watching his place. But yeah, some minor changes in how this scene relates to the film. And Ernest Tidyman did co-write the screenplay, so he had a direct hand in all of this.
Oh, yeah. One more thing, Gus. I do recall, similar to what I think I'm hearing with the book, he did have a contentious relationship with Buford. You know, kind of like the book as well as the movie was taking its time to deal over the argument that black people were engaged in during that time, quote unquote, black nationalism, whatever that means, and black people just trying to make as much money as they can, that sort of thing. And they put it in the terms of Shaft's personality and his ambition versus the quote unquote black militant. That's what Buford represented. Yeah. I hear it in the book also.
Yes, they keep that theme. They just, I think they spend a little bit more time on it in the book, but yes, mm-hmm. it's there yeah. both ways. The name calling, and I think Buford calls Shaft and Uncle Tom and all the rest of it. And you think like a white man, like that's in both of them. Let's see. And this, again, coming from a white author, even that is something yeah. I had to ponder. A white man writing a book where a black person calls another black person an Uncle Tom. Like, that is reason, like 5,000 reasons right there. I am never going to call a black person Uncle Tom again. Like, I'm just doing exactly what Ernest Tidyman, you know, wrote, like literally wrote this script. Ernest Tidyman wrote this script. Let's see. We have one of our investors wrote in. Let's see. Greetings, Gus. Chapter 6. Shaft. He had underestimated the black nationalist, Ben Buford. He had deliberately unleashed a maniac upon himself. Buford had 40 or 50 more pounds to spend on his rage. He was screaming out of his mind, "I'll kill you, rotten, faggot cocksucker." Buford was raging out of an almost catatonic blackness. The insane eyes were lighted anew with anger. Buford is characterized as a completely unhinged so-called black nationalist. The fact that one character who seems to be trying to counter racism, white supremacy, is characterized as crazy is interesting given the fact that the author is white. Very important. I think we were saying that last week. Like, it seems like these guys, because I think Henry in Chicago asked, like, who are they supposed to be based on real life, if anyone? I was saying for the book to come out in 1970, movie a year later, Black Panther Party still exists. So that would kind of fit. You have other so-called revolutionary organizations, just black people trying to replace white supremacy with justice. Lots of that type of activity at this time. So this could just kind of be a suspected racist composite of black people. And this is how he sees them. A black person who is trying to replace white supremacy with justice is crazy. And they got a whole book about that, Protest Psychosis, also written by a white man. Not ignorant about racism. I have more to say about that section because I highlighted it as well. Chapter 7. 1. He was part of their fantasies, scared the hell out of them. Big black man with his big black. The author seems obsessed with Shaft's shaft. I want to pause right here. I try to do my homework for all of the programs we have on the cows, right? We had white guests on the program last week. I read their books. We have white and non-white guests coming. Whether I spending my time online begging to get Ron Lack's book so I can read his Henrietta Lack's The Untold Story. Trying to be prepared. Same thing with this book, trying to find out more information about Ernest Tidyman. I spoke with Mr. Fuller, asking other black people who were alive at this time, did you know this was the product of a white man? Researching online, what information is there? Is there analysis of what, or what is G-rated? WTH. Why would a white man write a book where he seems obsessed with the black shaft? Why would a white man write this book in 1970 that becomes a film franchise for 50 years? They don't have that analysis. In doing my research, I say, hey, Ernest Tidyman, he wrote 6 books in this series. I don't want to read them all. There are 5 different Shaft movies. I don't know if I'm going to watch them all, but man, I flipped to watch Shaft's big score. That's another sexual title, because they say, did you score? Meaning, did you successfully engage in sexual activity, sexual intercourse? Shaft's big score. Black person, name calling. They have a black police officer in this one, and they do some name calling, you Uncle Tom this and Sam bad and all the rest of it. So encouraged, again, Ernest Tidyman co-wrote the screenplay for Shaft's big score, which I believe came out in 1973, just 2 years after the first Shaft. And all of the same themes, super hyper sexualized. The main theme, the third movie, you should take a look at all of the like poster, movie posters and such for the films. The third one is Shaft in Africa. It has a picture of Shaft holding like a spear, a long rod, but the position of the rod, it looks like it's going literally from his groin area, and it looks like the rod could be like 20 feet. Yeah. It's literally like it's coming out and poking you in the face. And I have to read so you can hear the caption underneath all of this. So, you can check my Twitter. I put it on Facebook as well, Twitter, @UntilJustice. So the artwork reads, the brother man in the motherland, Shaft is sticking it all the way. Large image of Shaft, black male, with a dashiki on and nothing else. No pants. The dashiki looks like it stops just, and I mean by a thread long enough to cover his genitals. And the rod looks like it starts from there and is coming out and about to bop you in the face. And then the dashiki is wide open so you can see his chest and nude torso that has been talked about a lot. Like, we had a listener last week who called in. He said her mother told her, your mind is just dirty, trying to say that Shaft is talking about some phallic symbol. Tell her to look at the poster for Shaft in Africa. In fact, you can ask her, do you remember this? Did you see this? Did you go to the movies to see this? Shaft. Man. All right, getting back to Investor, chapter 7, number 2. The two men were fascinated. Listen to this black stud. They knew all about black men and black women. More inference of penis envy of black males by the author. What do they know? Perhaps they are fantasizing about supposed sexual deviancy among black males and females. This whole book, whole franchise in some way, maybe white people just fantasizing about sexual intercourse with black people, because that's a lot of what these films revolves around. Even the 2000 Shaft. Now that's John Singleton, the late John Singleton. Richard Roundtree is in it too, but it starts sexual intercourse. Literally, as the credits and things are going by, sexual intercourse, nude black bodies. Who was the intended audience for this film? I'll get to a few of my notes. Keep an eye out on the switchboard if other folks have observations, thoughts on the first portion of the reading. Let's see. So we picked up like midway in chapter 5. Right. Okay. 5 of their own people cut down with machine guns, and it might have been backfire. This is when the enforcement officials, they're upset. I think we ended last week. The mafia members, they come and shoot up where Shaft had just met Ben Buford and his group. and they shoot and kill five of his people. Really gruesome. That's both in the book and the film. So the police are now investigating their mess. And this sounds so like cliche. They say this right now, like it's cliche almost. That's black people. No count black people. They don't snitch. That's why all the crime, black on black crime. And you all were like, you could insert this in 2021 easy. Like 50 years hasn't even passed. Same talking points. But he says, that's one later on. We'll get to that too. Let's see. Thought of Colin Powell when they mentioned driving by the United Nations building and talking about the speech he made to the UN. Let's see. I do not think it was in New York, but I'll double check on that. Let's see. When describing who possibly did this killing, Tiedemann writes, black men don't kill that way, not when they're killing each other. I never saw a black killing that wasn't crime of one passion or another. This wasn't. This was a goddamn massacre in the closing of a trap, as only a white man would do it. Now that is precise. That almost sounds like Django Unchained, if folks remember the scene where Leonardo DiCaprio has the skull and is talking about how black people don't fight back and are cowardly and all the rest of it. Same type of thing. Black people don't have the intellectual capacity to carry out a coordinated massacre like this. The Negroes are just all, you know, emotion. And, you know, you stepped on my foot and got angry and I'm gonna kill you and that sort of thing. That's the Negro crime. Not plotting, getting the information together, and just going out and doing it impersonally. Now, wow. White people ignorant about black people. Let's see. And then second, now he's having this whole theory like, now if they say this is a racial killing of some sort, right? These five black people were killed, black males, by some white hoodlums or what have you. Oh my goodness, what's going to happen? The city will be in an uproar, you know, have protests and all of that. What? Incidentally, that whole theory or idea is not in the film, that this could have been some sort of racial killing and the city will be in an uproar. That's totally tossed. But yeah, it doesn't seem like there's tremendous uproar about, we don't hear any more about the deaths of these black males anymore in the book, Black Lives Matter, from the white author. Let's see. The description of really all of the descriptions of the black males in this book, but the description of Ben Buford after all of this, Shab thought he looked, talking about Ben Buford, thought he looked like a big skinny bug in a museum exhibit without his jacket on and the gold-rimmed spectacles glittering a reflection of the kitchen lights. Not a human being. And a vermin of some sort, you know, an insect. Let's see. When they get to the end of chapter 5, they're going to Knox Parsons. He says the Cadillac suddenly, quietly pulled up in front of Knox Parsons' castle. He wanted Buford to go in carrying the knowledge that this little bitch he'd never seen, not John Shaft, was the cause of 6 deaths so far. Maybe a lot more to come. Just that alone. A white man wrote this. That's what I said. Now, if I'm Richard Roundtree, really any black person, Gordon Parks, and I read this book, do I want to be involved in this project? One we can think on, but Beatrice is not referred to as a bitch in the movie, thankfully. She is in the book. She's like totally degraded. In the movie, she doesn't have a speaking part. She's not running the streets and, you know, person of the night, as they say. None of that applies. Innocent little sweet girl, been kidnapped unjustly. That's it. She doesn't have a speaking part or anything, but, you know, none of this, where she's just totally degraded here. Like, Wow. Okay, Ernest Tidyman, let us know how you feel. This little bitch is to blame. Chapter 6. Knox nodded at the tall beige bag of angles and degrees. He didn't get up or offer a hand. Buford wasn't bending either. He silently assessed the big black man through the shimmering ovals of the wire-bound spectacles, then granted a nod in return. All of the detail and attention on the large size of all of these black males, really, he does a lot of that with Knox Parsons and talks about Shaft's big forearms. Like, there just seems to be a lot of homoeroticism throughout the book in terms of focusing on the physiques of black males in particular, and even, I might even say, disdain for black females at times. I have to pay attention to that as we are, certainly for Beatrice. I have to, you know, kind of pay attention as we're moving along. Later, Shaft thought he's talking about Parsons and Buford. These bastards really picked up on each other fast. They were so goddamn cool, but their minds were tearing at each other, ripping and smashing at each other like a couple of studs hungry for the same woman. What a metaphor from a white male author about these black males that he's envisioning, you know, having some sort of conflict with each other that's on par with studs. Now, that's just straight plantation language. Studs, whether you're talking about horses or slaves, that's straight plantation language. Studs. Angry over the same way. And in that context, I'd say, no, you're talking about straight slave context. White male author, what are you obsessed with the black Shaft? 6 books of these he wrote. Let's see. He goes from there. The long, lean body struck him in the side of the head like a screaming spear from a catapult hidden in the forest of the white rug. So we get both, again, the focus on the black body, and he gets hit not like a sledgehammer, not like a Molotov cocktail, not like a police baton, a spear, which I said, phallic symbol. Look at the movie poster, Shaft in Africa. We got another spear, and it's going right to the phallus. And they have, and I mean reams, it's more books and dissertations and theses on spears being used as a phallic symbol or metaphor for the black penis throughout the centuries of white supremacy racism. This is, I say, plantational, colonial, however you want to look at it. Very old metaphor, like Heart of Darkness, all that stuff. Joseph Conrad, knowing our racist literature. Let's see. So in the middle of the fight between Ben Buford and Shaft, and none of this happens in the movie. There's no brawl. I think Ben Buford cocks back a fist. Shaft intervenes because he's going to sock Knox Parsons. And they just have a discussion about what's going to happen. The increase, all of the end result, Shaft gets more money, and they figure out what it's going to be and how they move forward. There's no big brawl. Shaft pulled a knee to cover his groin and threw his right arm in front of his face. The obsession. Parsons gets described as having ham big hands. I have never heard that in my life. I guess that means someone has large hands, but ham big hands? Okay, Ernest Tidyman. Let's see. Buford yells at Shaft. Now, this was our investor read before. I'll kill you, you rotten faggot cocksucker. Like, whoa. Time out. Was that in vogue at the time? Were, like, black revolutionaries? Was that the insult? not you, Uncle Tom, not you, sellout, not you, coon, you rotten, faggot, cocksucker. Hmm. She said, the listener last week, she said her mother told her that her mind was in the gutter. Let's see. Shaft tells Buford and Parsons, I'm going to get the fuck out of here and let you two eat each other. I don't even know what that means. Like, what? What? Again, is this slang from the 1970s? I wasn't born at this time, so maybe I'm stupid. Maybe I'm just missing out. I've heard some of the slang, cool, fresh things that people were saying, hip, in that era. I've heard that before. Dig it. I have not heard eat each other. What? Homoeroticism, every paragraph. Let's see. So much of it goes back to the rectum revolution, my ass. You just found a new way to chase pussy, although there's no evidence of that. I don't remember him saying there were females in the building, in the room when he went to meet Buford, or females chasing him down the street or anything of the kind. But how much homework you've ever done? Let's see. Next. When they describe how the mafia members are upset because Knox Parsons is moving into territory that's supposed to be for the Spicks, as they say in the book, all of this is like exactly out of The Godfather, which came out at the exact same time the movie did. But that's exactly, they have the whole scene, you know, we're going to be controlled about this and, you know, let the niggas lose their soul and all of that. Exactly, you know, same way. Patterns in the system of white supremacy. But they say they thought they were throwing a scrap to the Spicks, who could be controlled at the sources, but it didn't work that way. Crime and profit, basic to nature, won't tolerate the vacuum either. Parsons had moved in. It was very funny. He had probably even absorbed the Spaniards without much difficulty. What the hell? Half of them were black. And getting blacker through the integration of poverty and ghetto isolation. Getting blacker. Huh. Now, that is fascinating. He didn't all the way through it even suggest, hey, all of the non-white people are black. You can just get blacker. We mistreat you a little bit more. Take away some of the resources we allow you to have, and you could be blacker too, whatever that means. Next. Now, this one is fed. Buford is talking to Knox Parsons about all this drug pushing. He says, one day it's going to be a crime for a son of a bitch like you to call himself black, for you, for him, for everybody else who stands for and with the corruption of the community. You're going to see the day when a black man doesn't suck the blood of his brother and give it back in junk and gin and drive his Cadillacs on the indifference in the price. Now, that's at least the second time where we have a white author talking about black people in Cadillacs, where, again, they have literature. Why is it that black people have such an affinity for Cadillacs? Oh, the white supremacist practices where whites wouldn't allow individuals classified as black to get housing loans, redlining, as they call it. You don't allow black people to own homes and property in so many areas. One of the very limited ways that black people could show some wealth or advancement, really show offism, but, you know, Flashy clothes, flashy car. Cadillac has been a flashy car for many, many years. That doesn't get up fast, just you dumb niggers running around in your Cadillacs. Ernest Tidyman giving us this, like, let's see. Anything else to share? Chapter 7. I did have notes in Chapter 7. Tidyman describes Ben as walking out like a dog after this meeting is over with. He was called a bug before. You know, again, what is this? What is he even communicating? Again, this is the only black character who is trying to work against racism. And repeatedly, he's described as something other than a human. Let's see. They get to the bar. Let's see. It's changed in the movie. Nickerson, gay white man we talked about, he doesn't slap him on the shoulder, which is what happens in the book. That's a slap on the rear end. Let's see. Just like Woody Allen, we get a scene where Nickerson is, I guess, a big New Orleans jazz fan. And he says he has this big conversation about Jelly Roll Morton, asks Shaft if he's familiar with all this. Nickerson met the scene where Jelly tells how a confrontation was built on a crescendo of threats and outrageous warnings. It was funky, old-fashioned nigger talk that Lomax made part of history by recording for the Library of Congress. I think he means Louis Lomax, black male. Again, this is another one where it's like, wow, again, reminded me of Woody Allen. He was just talking about his affinity for black male musicians in New Orleans. And so to have this, like, wow, fantasizing about black people. White people have been doing that for a long time. And being able to hear some old-fashioned nigger talk, like, I'm sure Tidyman loved being able to write that. And again, who is this book marketed for? It's got to be white people, I'm thinking. That's what I said. The question has got to be, do we think Ernest Tidyman was really intending this for white readers? Excuse me, black readers? Black readers? He's white, so it's already, yeah, white people. I'm white. Of course they'll read it. I know what white people like. I'm white. Do we think he was writing this for black people? Was the movie really intended even for black people? They would have to know. Black people are already going to go. It's got black people in it. Let's see. You already got the fantasy with the white woman. Oh, my goodness. They get the two white guys who are at the bar as gangsters to hunt down Shaft. Shaft is, you know, plying them with liquor, you know, get them all on his side, like, oh, my goodness. And Tidyman writes, they said it jovially because they told him, you know, don't go too hard on the liquor. We got to drive. You said it jovially, fraternally. This was a good spade. You wouldn't see this one out starting riots, mugging people, slashing the canvas of your uncle's new Cadillac convertible, that Cadillac again. This one brought drinks. A good spade. Whatever that means. I'd like to be a good spade too. Incidentally, a white man would know. This is how other white people would see you. Like, this is the best you can hope for. A good spade. Any other thoughts, observations folks need to get in? First audio segment.
Yes. I do think that the founder of the idea of Shaft made the movie for black people. I'm going to tell you why, because they kind of like twisted around different stereotypes and made Shaft out of a hero, they even, the gangster even had some humility in the movie where he shed a tear to Shaft because he, his baby, as he stated in the movie, was kidnapped. And in turn, the female in the movie was projected as, you know, very innocent. Even the gangster father stated that my baby never did anything wrong. She was a college student at that time. That was, I think, during that period was probably the largest time that black females were in college at that time. Also, it was a lot of settings. Even with the arguing between Shaft and Buford. That's another thing with the difference understandings, even in real quote unquote black life, we would like to see it work out all right in the end. And that's what happened in the movie. So all what that tells me is white people know us pretty well. They know us pretty well, and I'm pretty sure they made pretty good money. The original Shaft. Now those other ones, those two other ones that had Richard Roundtree in it, they kind of like fell by the wayside. And most movies are like that. When you try to get a part one and a part two and part three, they don't work out that well at all. And that certainly happened. With that particular series, I don't know what was the report on when the other actor who is a major actor now, I can't think of his name right now, when he took on that role of Shaft. I don't know what was the report on that, but I'm talking about the ones with Richard Roundtree, and I never was interested in the other ones, you know, at all. At the time I went to see Shaft, I was something like. I think maybe 15, something like that, 15, 16 years old, something like that. That was something that was the in style thing to do, was go downtown and see the movie Shaft. They even joked about it on the radio because it was R-rated. If you wanted to go see Shaft, ask your mama. That was a clip, a commercial clip on the popular quote unquote black radio station during that time. You know, so it was quite popular, Shaft 1. And I think they did make it for, the white people did make it for black people. Yeah, that's it.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. One of the listeners wrote in and just talking about, you know, all the advertising and what have you. He said he remembered seeing the advertisements in the middle of Times Square in New York City, huge, like billboards and all the other promos, and it's set in New York, so, you know, already going to have an audience for that, but it released July 4th weekend, so they intended for a lot of folks to see this film. Incidentally, I guess real quick, I will say that is true. In the film, it's Bumpy, not Knox Parsons. But he does shed a tear for his daughter. But very soon after that, he gets up to leave. Shaft laughs at him and calls him a phony. So he doesn't even believe that this is, you know, he thinks there's some act going on with this. And then with the daughter, she is innocent in the film. But like I said before, you don't really see her. She has a very minuscule part. In fact, I don't think you see her until I think more than half of the movie has gone by before you actually get to see her. And then you get to see her very briefly. And in fact, she's not even in college yet. Bumpy, he says that she's going to college, but either way, you don't see her. It's not like,
yeah.
You don't really get a chance to like connect to her the way, like with Gabby Petito. Like they, you know, you get to see her video and pictures and all the rest of it so that you can, oh man, connect and empathize. Like that's not in Shaft at all. Like the pretty much the only person that you're going to connect and identify with is Shaft. Like, everybody else is, you know, way in. Bumpy's daughter is, like, way, way down because you just don't, you know. But, yeah, that is, we can think about that. Do people think this was made for Black people? And it certainly was heavily promoted. But like I said, it's got a lot of Black people in it. You're already going to get them. Especially at this time. This was back when you didn't have Obama on TV every day. But we'll ponder on it and get to audio segment number two. Picking up in the middle of chapter 8. Ernest Tidyman's Shaft. Context of white supremacy. Audio segment number 2.
Okay. He looked a little crestfallen as he put the receiver in the hook. Shit, he said. Women just don't give a man no room at all to play. He reached for the scotch bottle again as they smiled in oily understanding. Gives you a hard time? One of the business suit asked. Not as hard as I give her. They laughed at that. They were still laughing when he dialed another number and let it demand another presence from the night of sleep. He reached for the scotch with his free hand and sipped at it. Andorazzi, the voice said, sleepy too, but hard and ready. Hey, baby, Shaft chuckled as lasciviously as he could. How you doing? Who is this? Hey, baby, this is Jelly Roll. I've been thinking about you. How quickly would Andorazzi pick up on the voice? God damn it, wake up. Yeah, well, I've been thinking about you too, Shaft, but right now I'm sleeping. The hell do you want? How about you coming down to see old Big Jim? I got what you want, baby. The two men were fascinated. They were forgetting their routine of watching out the window. Listen to this black stud make out with this broad. Listen to him sweet talk her into the compliance that was so sweet and easy for her. They knew all about black men and black women. Andorazzi was totally awake. Okay, he snapped. Where are you? Look, honey, I'm down to the no-name bar right now, but this old bar got to close sometime. They're going to throw old Jim out in the cold. How about you coming down here? How many are there? Oh, it's about 2 right now. Yeah. Where? Up front, baby. I'm up front with you. Two hoods were excited. They weren't sure how he was going to make out. They looked eager, warm about it. They wanted him to get the girl in the end. We'll come in on all sides of the place. For Christ's sakes, get down on the floor. Don't play hero. Hey, baby, he murmured. Now that's the sweet talk I likes to hear. Don't you worry about the cab. Old Big Jim gonna take care of that. He raised his eyes to the leering hoods. And you too. Give or take a few degrees of tension, he thought it was the coolest moment. He wondered who else he might call as he put down the receiver and shared smiles of male duplicity with the hoods. He discarded the idea of another call, too foolish. Coming across, one of them asked. Yeah, man, he cackled. He shook the idea of playing games out of his head. That was the whiskey talking. He wasn't drunk enough or fool enough to be listening. He leaned back against the wood of the back bar, raised one foot up on the low shelf that ran under the bar itself. Nickerson or somebody else had left a package of Marlboros on the shelf. Shaft shook one out of the box, lighted it, and blew smoke out of his nostrils like a black dragon. In about 10 minutes, give or take an eternity, those clowns were going to look up and see a green and white patrol car drive through the front door of the no-name bar, maybe the side door at the same time. He leaned down to look once again at the pistol hanging under the mahogany. Almost out of lemons, he said, when he straightened up. One of the men glanced at him quizzically. Use a lot of lemons here, Shaft added. Maybe 3-4 dozen. He had the gun in his hand as soon as he saw what was happening. It was 1 second before the hoods reacted. Three figures came in the side door. They said nothing. They stood in line with 12-gauge Remington shotguns leveled at the faces of the men at the bar, over and around the few customers who remained. In that second, Shaft's hand came up and rested on the bar, the muzzle of the pistol about 15 inches from either of the two. Two figures glided past the window a few feet away and pushed into the no-name through the front door. 2 more shotguns. No, no, Shaft said coldly and clearly. Just don't do it. Just sit there. They were stunned. Awareness lighted in their eyes.
They were trained and practiced at this. They could smell a cop around a corner and down a city block. Now they had five of them around them, moving around them in a circle of riot guns, and a big black man at their backs with a cocked pistol. Up, he said when they checked the automatic movement toward their own guns. Up! The manicured hands rose above their heads. One of the cops came forward carefully, quickly, the riot gun still straight out in one hand, still at the middles of the pair. His free hand snaked with professional skill inside the jackets and waistbands and down the pant legs, coming out with three pistols that went into the capacious pockets of his black London Fog raincoat. He handed the riot gun to another one and snapped chrome handcuffs on the hoods. All right, said the cop, who seemed to be in charge of the detail. Let's get him out of here. Shaft noticed that the no-name was totally silent, probably for the first time in its history. You coming along with us, Mr. Shaft? The officer asked. The two hoods turned their outrage on him. Shaft lifted the bottle of Johnny Walker. You want one more before you go? He invited. The toad in the sports jacket spit in his face. He had only half recoiled, licking his lips when the bottle broke across the cheekbone in a spray of whiskey, glass, and blood. A cop cursed. A girl screamed. Okay, the head cop said. We'll stop at St. Vincent's first and get him sewn up. Let's go. 8. He couldn't help it. That's the way he was. Circumstance and response, cause and effect were almost like Siamese twins of his nature, closer together than a couple of Harlem tenements. There was no room there for thought, reflection, or perspective. The ball of his anger bounced from one hard wall to the other before there was time. Later, it made him wonder if he had not made a mistake. But it would be much later, months later. There would be no guilt or self-doubt with his questions, for he was not questioning himself or his actions, only the results. There was a small cut on Shaft's hand. A jagged chunk of the scotch bottle had tripped over the flesh of his calloused palm on its flight to the floor. The incision was neat, painless, but bloody, like most. He ignored the rules of antiseptics and put his mouth over the cut to suck on it. The blood was warm, salty, and scotch-tasting. He spat it out into the drained sink beneath the bar. My name is Count Dracula, Roy Nickerson said, bugging his eyes in his Bela Lugosi imitation. I live in a castle in Transylvania, and I don't take shit from nobody. Nickerson and the girls were all that remained of the no-name's business. The police had suggested that everybody go home for the night. Everybody had taken it to heart. They left Nickerson and his companions because the actor had explained that he was the bartender. That man is an imposter, he said of Shaft. And these, with a wave at the girls, are the night porters. He was smashed. The cops went away after Shaft told the officer in charge of the detail that he would talk to Andorazzi about the two hoods. There was time. He had to do something about getting himself together first. Where the hell was his coat? Hanging on a hook near the cigarette machine. He held the bleeding hand under the faucet, looking up over the rim of the bar at Nickerson and the girls. When actors got nervous, he thought, they could slip into other roles outside the ones in which life had trapped them. Nickerson was deep into Dracula fantasy. The girls were giggling. If you will just let me fasten these electrodes to your lovely head, my dear, he was saying. I'm sure the experience will give you a charge. Shaft considered the cut. It had pretty much stopped bleeding. There was a small tin box of Band-Aids next to the cash register. Bartenders are always slicing fingers with the lemons. One of those would have been enough. The hood who had taken the bottle in the head was probably undergoing his own first aid at that moment. A lot more than this, he thought, pleased. He had felt bone give under the impact of the bottle. He checked around the bar for vodka, found a bottle of Gilby's behind him, and held it in his left hand while he pulled the cork with his teeth. The alcohol burned fiercely as he poured it into the cut. His only indication of it was the momentary bulge of muscles in his cheeks. As long as you're wasting good whiskey, old fellow, Nickerson said, switching off Lugosi into something like Terry Thomas or Peter Sellers, losing the character in the fog of alcohol. Would you be kind enough to waste a bit on us? Raleigh pushed the glasses forward across the bar. Shaft put the vodka bottle beside them. Just help yourself, Shaft said, turning to the Band-Aid box behind the register. He tore the wax paper off one of the adhesive strips with his teeth. Let me do it for you, one of the girls volunteered.
She was small, slender, dark, and her nose was a little too big. A spinner. Was it Nickerson who had told him about spinners? You put them out on the end of your cock and give them a twist. They spin like a propeller on a beanie. Nickerson, somebody, whoever, it didn't matter. She wasn't bad. Her nose would go away if you looked at it long enough. It was like saying a word over and over in your head. After a while, it just didn't mean anything. Jeff handed her the Band-Aid. Lights around them went from soft amber glow to a dim, murky shadow outline gloom. She protested. I can't see to put on this bandage. Nickerson was at the small black switch box on the rear wall along the hall to the toilets. Feel your way around, Raleigh said. He likes that. She managed. Even in the darkness, the flesh-toned strip of adhesive glowed against the heel of his hand where it covered the cut. The spinner's fingers against his palm were cool, quick, efficient. He wondered, remembering the line from Lenny Bruce or Dick Gregory, if Johnson & Johnson would one day bring out black Band-Aids for the 25 million other flesh tones. He answered his own speculation. No, they wouldn't. The other one, she was even a little smaller and more finely drawn than his nurse, who had gone to work pouring vodka. Nickerson came back from the light box. It should keep them out, he said. Why'd you hit the man with the bottle? The second spinner said. Shaft was searching for another Johnny Walker. He wouldn't stop putting ice cubes in the ashtrays, Nickerson said. I don't mind that so much, Shaft said, finding a new bottle, pouring his own drink. But when he said our people couldn't swim there, the girl shut up about it. You going to close down? He asked Nickerson. I have to wait till he gets here and counts the money. You? Shaft tilted the glass. He was only about 3 or 4 away from being stoned himself. I still got some work to do. He looked at the first spinner's nose. Maybe change the bandage. He walked back down to the end of the bar, reached under it, got the .38 again. He stuck it into his right rear pocket. Will he notice that it's gone? He asked Nickerson. I don't know, maybe. Tell him the police took it with the two hoods and said they'd bring it back if they found it was registered. Nickerson nodded. You want to come help me change the bandage? He asked the girl. Her nose looked better all the time. She picked up the cigarettes on the bar, stuck them in her purse, and had one last strong pull at the vodka tonic. She was standing beside the bar stool, waiting to go across the street with him by the time he got his coat off the wall hook. Take care, man, Nickerson said. You too. He raised his hand in a small, cool wave. The .38 felt like a sash weight that would drag his pants down around his ankles. The $10,000 package, that's $250s, bulged uncomfortably in the other pocket. He pushed open the door, then turned back as the girl went out into the night before him. I owe you a good one, he said. It was the closest Shaft could get to gratitude without embarrassing either one of them. Nickerson smiled at him and nodded at the departing, waggling behind of the girl. Shaft followed the path of the actor's eyes. It was too bad about her nose, he thought. She had a great ass. Wait, baby, he said, thinking also that he didn't even know her name. It's the other way, that white building across the street. Why don't you bring him in for questioning? The commissioner suggested. No, said Andarazzi. He's better doing it this way, whatever he's doing. Look, the mayor isn't crazy. You want me to tell him that the police department of the city of New York is waiting for information and advice from some spade private eye he never heard of? Then don't tell him. Does he tell you when he rides his bicycle? There's no comparison. There's none between what we can find out and what Shaft has been finding out either. You know any black radicals? I don't. Shaft's talking with them. You know anybody who can deal with Knox Persons? I don't. Shaft's working for the old bastard. You know why the mob decides to gun down 5 black militants in the streets of Harlem? I don't. But Shaft sends us 2 greaseball punks, one with a slightly broken head, who probably know the answer. Maybe even have been there. 48 hours ago, you were worried about sending tanks up Amsterdam Avenue. Now you're suggesting that I stop the man who's got his foot on the fuse? I don't like the way this is going. No cop could, but let's be pragmatic about it. The choice is going by the book, by the rules, making the mayor happy, maybe ending up with a couple hundred people dead and $30 or $40 million worth of riot damage, or letting one man work outside the rules and maybe preventing all of that. We can't protect him. The hell we can't. We have to.
If Shaft turns the wrong corner and plays tag with the front end of a truck, we've had it.
How tough is he?
Not as tough as he thinks he is. Probably a hell of a lot tougher than anybody realizes. Somewhere between there. If there's anything that will keep him going, it's probably the fact that he is alone. He is black, and he does believe he's going to survive. Why? He doesn't stop to think a lot. He acts. And every ounce of the man is muscle and anger. Let me know what turns up on those two creeps from the bar. Yes, sir. The phone was silent. Andarazzi dropped it back into the cradle. He would call the station and see what the fingerprints of the two hoods showed about their origin and background. He'd let the commissioner know. Maybe he would call Chef first. He wondered what the big black bastard was doing and to whom. He lay back down and snuggled against the warm, soft form of his wife. Chef thought that if he stopped to count all the things he had to do right then, right that minute without delay, he'd need the fingers of a centipede. This thing was taking all his time, all his energy, and twice now, damn near all his life. He couldn't even remember the last time he'd gone to the bathroom. He only thought about it now because the scotch had been punching his kidneys and putting the pressure of urgency on his bladder. "Excuse me," he said to the girl. "You want a drink?" There's a bottle of scotch on top of the icebox and a bottle of vodka inside it. She had dropped into the one club chair over near the window and kicked off her shoes. Apparently, there was no question in her mind about why she was there. The first thing she did was to start taking her clothes off. "It's all right. I'll wait. I have to go to the Johnny, too." He smirked, but turned away so she couldn't see, walking to the bathroom. In about 10 minutes, she was going to have more Johnny than she knew what to do with. "What's your name?" he asked.
"Valerie."
"Valerie?"
"Uh-huh."
The name bothered him. It felt like a spider crawling across his memory. Some village broad named Valerie shot up a fruitcake painter a while back. It wasn't this one. She was in jail. He discarded the thought.
"Is your name Shaft, or do they just call you that?"
"They just call me that. I'll be right back." He stared at the red, fatigue-flushed whites of his eyes in the bathroom mirror, then got his first clear look at the collar of the shirt he'd been wearing for what was now turning into 3 days. It was a ring of stain, the city dirt blended with sweat. He looked down at the gray trousers, and they were a mess too, and the Drago shine with which he had begun the involvement in this no longer existed. It made him aware of how cruddy he felt from socks to collar. He had to get into the shower. Chef squirted toothpaste on the brush, put it on the edge of the sink, and stripped off his clothes. He didn't bother to hang them on the back of the bathroom door, just threw them in a corner of the bathroom. The 38 thumped when it hit the floor.
"Are you coming out?"
"Sure, sure, just a minute." He had forgotten all about her. Christ, this was too much. He picked up the toothbrush and stepped into the shower. He turned on the hot and cold faucets and jumped back to avoid the shock of the first cold spray out of the pipe. It got hot quickly, and he leaned into it to adjust the temperature to just below scalding, scrubbing away at his teeth at the same time. It was the best thing his body had felt for so long that he just stood there, letting the hot water beat upon him in a steaming cascade. Warm, wonderful water. He raised his face directly under the shower hood, about an inch from the holes through which the 100 streams of water gushed. He had to hold his breath, so warm, so soothing. It was all going to wash away. He was going to get out of that shower feeling fresh, strong, and ready. The touch on the small of his back startled him. He jumped and banged his skull on the shower head, spinning around on the slippery porcelain with a roar. "What in the hell?" he shouted. "Did I scare you?" she said. The shower was pouring over his shoulder onto her body, rippling down its slopes and summits in roisterous rivulets. She was laughing, and she had a bar of soap in her hand, moving to rub it across his chest. "I hope you're not ticklish," she said. "That's it," Shaft replied. "That's my name. Ticklish." There were 40 men in the room. Buford stood in the center of them. He was taller than most, more marked in his appearance than most. He stood on a steel and wood milk crate to emphasize both points. He was above them, and he was the center of them. He turned slowly on the box, resolving to give each sector of the group a portion of his message and promise. His right hand was raised and cocked like a pistol of flesh, pointing beyond their faces into their minds. how long you been waiting?
He demanded, the big voice controlled and grim, starting out slowly, looking for the rhythm.
How long you been waiting?
He repeated. Response was an inarticulate rumble, a mixture of much muttered phrases such as
400 years, too damn long, we've been waiting forever.
Too long,
Buford said.
Too long.
Continuing to revolve slowly like a mechanical doll turned by a device hidden in the milk crate, the voice leaped up to a roar.
Well, now we are not going to wait any longer. The time's come to do something more than talk about it.
40 throats roared in assent.
There's 5 voices missing tonight. 5 black faces you ain't going to see no more. 5 black bodies going to the grave today.
Silence, echoing silence through the big warehouse chamber of exposed beams, concrete floor, torn cobwebs, and a century of the accumulated dust that had seeped in through the rough construction. The crackling snuffle of men's shoes against the grime from which they had risen and in which they must walk, but heavy, great, dark shrouds of silence.
Buford exploded it. God damn! They are not going alone!
A deep, swelling roar, a hoarse growl of agreement and support.
We're going to start now. We're going to wake up this city. We're going to take one a day, one pig cop, one black man who lives off his brother's misery. You know the plans. Now is the time we use them.
A roar of assent, of eagerness. Restraint and planning had formed an uncomfortably tight leash. It was unhooked.
The team leaders stay with me now. We have to talk. The rest of you keep cool until you hear from them.
He continued to turn slowly on the box, trying to let his eyes touch on each face and bestow upon it the fulfillment of his promises and exhortations. All the beautiful, angry black faces shining with purpose and strength. Buford was troubled by a ragged scrap of thought about Shaft's talk of dealing. The faces before him told Buford that he did not need to deal. This was the power, and it was his.
Go,
he said. Why wasn't a man like Shaft with them for this? Where were men like Shaft when they were needed? This is why they call you Shaft, she said, her soapy hands moving down his flanks. His were on her breasts. The lubricity of the soap made them almost impossible to hold. His fingers squeezed and glided across the slopes to the rigid nipples. He pressed and popped them softly like grapes through the tips of his thumbs and forefingers. Shaft wanted to ask her why some women had full extended nipples, some had hardly any at all. It was no time for clinical questions. She began biting his chest, letting her teeth take little nips of the wet skin, hanging on to the moment before it became painful, then letting go and sliding her warm mouth an inch or so away. She had fingernails, too. Now her hands were moving up his sides to his shoulders, dragging the nails across the wet flesh. Baby, he whispered to her, right now. She was small, so light. His arms went around her waist, and he filled the cups of his hands with the rounded roll of her bottom, lifting her forward and upward. Her arms went around his neck, locked there, drawing his face down to her. Her legs parted and rose one at a time, around his, to lock behind his knees. Ah! She sighed as her body lowered on the rail of his flesh. And he went into her naturally, perfectly, with neither his hands nor hers guiding the slow thrust. She keened again. It was so smooth. Shaft was momentarily surprised. Was it the soap? Or the liquidity of her sex? Or that she was so open and eager for him? His body jerked compulsively in a spasmodic thrust, and he drove deeply into her, as deeply as he could, while her own body strained against him, his hands lifted her forward. Standing there, bodies locked beneath the steaming spray, they began to seek the rhythm. Shaft bent his knees and reached out his left hand behind her to brace the stance with a grip on the towel rack. As his fingers tightened on the wooden bar, he felt her body rise and fall in the movement of her pelvis, the slow and steady hammering of an impulse into ecstasy. She had aroused him intensely. It was the surprise of it, having her come into the shower after him. It was also the soapy, slithering ritual of the bath and the whorish quality of her giving it to him. He wanted to let go,
to drive and thrust without containment and explode within and around her. It was frequently his style for the sometimes girl, the casual exercise. But for this one, he would hold back. The way she had come to it deserved that. He would wait until she was screaming into his throat. Then he would let himself go, and it would happen. She began to moan. The hammer rose and fell more rapidly, spasmodically. She was only seconds away. The rigid bar of the towel rack bit into the flesh of his tightening hand. He never felt it. "I'm coming," she howled. So was Shaft. He had the feeling they were pitching out of the shower onto the tile floor. But he didn't care. The fact that there had been mistakes, serious mistakes, seeped through the pain in Carmen Caroli's crushed face with persistent anxiety. They had been his mistakes. He knew, and he would pay a variety of penalties for them beyond what he was already suffering in physical damage and the shame of having been taken by the nigger, of having ended up in jail with his head wrapped in bandages and his life once again caught in the hamburger machine of the law. His mind moved slowly in review of those penalties as he sat on the edge of the bunk in the cell and stared at the steel plate floor. He wished he could lay back on the bunk and sleep. Each time he had tried, the throbbing in his head rose like the fury he felt when the cops came into the bar. He played out an imaginary conversation in his head, a dialogue with his brother Charlie, who would be the first to express the anger over what had happened. "Might he hit you with the bottle?" Charlie demanded. "Who knows?" he said, sounding confused, dumb, because Charlie sometimes accepted his dumbness as an excuse. "All niggas are crazy. As soon as the cops had the cuffs on me, he leans over and hits me with the bottle. Somebody must have tipped him off that we were after him. It made him mad." "What do you mean, tipped him?" It had been the wrong path, even in a fantasy. He always took the wrong path, trying to explain to Charlie. To say that somebody tipped the nigger meant that one of the people who knew they were after the nigger had done it. And the only people who knew were Charlie and the other ones Charlie was with. Saying one of them caused it was more dangerous than getting caught. He always remembered these things too late. Now he had to weasel out of it. "But how else would he know who we were?" He let his voice in the fantasy have more indignation than he would allow it if the confrontation had been real. But his fantasy was honest with him, and Charlie snarled, just as he always did. "Jesus Christ, with you two apes sitting in that saloon across from his apartment, how could he help but know who you were?" Charlie was always right when they looked back on what had happened. That was why Charlie didn't trust him with much. He went on from the worst anxieties, facing his brother, to the lesser of them. 3 to 5, he thought. He would probably do 3 to 5 for the gun rap. That was easy. 3 to 5 was nothing unless the judge was wrong for him. Came up one of those guys who make speeches with each sentence so they can get their names in the papers. Then the 3 to 5 might be 5 to 10. Well, that was bad. The days eventually passed. They weren't such bad days. You always knew what was coming next in them. And when they ran out, you could go home, if you had a home. Would he have a home? That penalty also crossed his mind with a dull trudge. He would lose Angela for sure. 3 to 5, she might still be around. 5 to 10, she'd have to go with somebody else. Who? He felt a twinge of jealousy. Made his head hurt. What difference did it make who? Somebody. Anybody. There were guys around who wanted her and would take care of her. And Charlie, who would stay mad at him for almost ever, he would stay mad for the entire 3 to 5. But would he stay mad for 5 to 10? If he did, if Charlie wasn't there when he got out, it might as well be 20 to life. Carmen shuffled his feet across the steel floors without rising from the cot. The anxiety over Charlie's possible absence was too strong to continue. It drove his mind toward other concerns. The girl. He thought about her, crapped out on the bed in the small room over Thompson Street. They had given her the jolt of the stuff that Charlie had brought around. Bang in the arm, and she was out for 6 or 8 hours. "Shoot her in the ass, shoot her in the arm. What the hell difference does it make?" Charlie said. "Just don't give her more than up to that little red line on the hypo. You understand?" He understood that. He did it carefully, slowly. Why didn't Charlie just let him do that? Sit there watching over the girl. He and Eddie read the papers and talked about the Mets and broads and some jobs they'd done. Why had Charlie taken them out of the room and sent them after the nigger? "She'd be asleep for 6 hours for sure," he said. "Nothing's going to happen to her. I'll stay. I want you to find this guy, Shaft, this Spade. and go over him good. Don't kill him, understand? Just break a couple things, his arm, his ankles, maybe. I want to talk to him when he's slowed down some. You understand? You don't kill him. You just slow him down. Then you come back here straight. He had understood. He'd been a simple child. But somehow, he had blown it. Again. He wondered how mad Charlie was. He wondered what that big nigger was doing.
Big nigger. That's what we will end at for this week. Pick up on chapter 9. And as I said, this book is not very long. We'll be on chapter 9 for the beginning of next week. And this book only goes to chapter 14. So we are already well beyond the halfway point. Maybe that we only have two sessions left and we all done with Shaft. Number to dial, 720-716-7300. Decode 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. I'll get in our listeners, person who wrote in, get their written commentary, rest of it for chapter 8. Number 2. Oh, wait a minute. Chapter 8, we back up a little bit. A spinner. Was it Nickerson who told him about spinners? You put them on the end of your cock and give them a twist. They spin like the propeller on a beanie. Never heard of this term. More phallus imagery by the author. I had never heard of this term either. Number 2, Andarazi. He wondered what the big black bastard was doing and to whom. He lay back down and snuggled against the warm, soft form of his wife. The juxtaposition of phallus imagery and Andarazi cuddling with his wife is fascinating. Is the detective dreaming of Shaft? This book is weird. That is putting it mildly, friend. Like, what in the world? That's all you can conclude, right? That's a logical conclusion. I don't think that's, you know, having your mind in the gutter or anything. Like, what am I to think? And we've seen this before. We had a white author on the program. This is way back in 2013. He lives in Seattle. If you give me some time, I'll get the exact title and everything. But he wrote a book where he chronicled the Seattle Supersonics, who are no longer here, Oklahoma, but he chronicled the Seattle Supersonics for the 1994-95 season. And he has a passage where sometimes he goes to Sonics games, sometimes he's watching Sonics games when on the road and whatever. But this one time, he see Gary Payton was on the team at the time. And he just loves Gary Payton, like, oh, my gosh, he's got so much swag, and he's so cool, and all the rest, blah, 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 and he's talking trash, a la Shaft. And he has a passage where he says he's thinking about Gary Payton and how cool he is and the way that he talks and just, wow, that is a cool black dude. And I thought about him, and then I went upstairs and had sex with my wife. We talked about this passage with him on the program. Like, I've seen this repeatedly. And I, what am I to think? I don't know if I had homoeroticism in. Maybe I did. You have to go back and listen. But I hadn't read Delectable Negro to see, like, oh, this is a repeated trope. White people fantasizing about sexual intercourse with a black male. White men fantasizing. About sex. Donald Sterling, man. We just read Woody Allen. I said the same thing there. Next, number 3. In about 10 minutes, she was going to have more Johnny than she knew what to do with. Awesome. Woo.
Johnson, right? They say Johnson, like, man, oh, man. Tidyman never tires of phallus double entendres. Am I correct that Shaft is only having sex with white women? One of Tidyman's many wives was a white woman who was a singer for Motown named Chris Clark. She was known as the White Negress. She co-wrote the screenplay for Lady Sings the Blues. I read that. Now, that's all about Billie Holiday. Richard Pryor's in it, Diana Ross, I believe. Negro classic. White woman wrote the screenplay. Isn't that crazy? She did Lady Sings the Blues. And then she's married to the guy who did Shaft. Like, anyway, the question was asked, in the book, is Shaft exclusively having sex with white women? That's my conclusion. The woman, Valerie, there wasn't anything that I could lock in on to say, oh, yeah, she's definitely a white woman. He had the commentary about her nose being too wide. But, I mean, it wasn't anything specific. There certainly wasn't anything that gave me the impression that she was a black female. The first female that he had sex with, I said, oh, yeah, this is a white woman. He talked about the contrast of his skin and all the rest of it. And I think even Valerie, there was some of that when she was putting on the Band-Aid. But I think she is white. In the movie, the woman that he meets at the bar and takes home and has sex with is white. She puts on the Band-Aid and all that. It is a white woman. So if it matches the film, white. We'll see if any other folks have thoughts on that. Let's see. Folks who dialed in, star 61, if you have thoughts to share. Let's see. I see retired firefighter with us. I'll look for other hands as we roll along. Thoughts, observations on the second audio segment?
Yes. The person in the movie was a white woman. Another thing that was consistent with Richard Roundtree's role in the movie Shaft was he always had a smart comment in the end, especially when he was conversing with white people. He always had a smart what is called a smart aleck comment. And he would have the last word in all of the conversations. The detective that dealt with him directly in the movie, it portrayed that he understood the Richard Roundtree version of Shaft. And, you know, just let him get away with it. Therefore, he had a, quote unquote, good relationship with him. Even the white female he had sex with, he had the last word as he quickly escorted her out of his apartment door after having sex with her. Those, like I said before, the movie indicates on how white people understands their victims. The sex was more or less contrived as revenge on the man, you know, that's how it was portrayed in not only that movie, but most of those type of movies during that time. Having sex with a white woman is like what Malcolm X said in his biography or it was somewhere I heard even his voice was saying that to have the white man's pride would be the top prize for a black male, you know, that sort of thing. And that was definitely portrayed in that movie in itself. What else? Yeah, those are my thoughts on the second reading. It did kind of like go in the version of the movie itself, but I think almost naturally books, when it comes to books, is more intellectualized. The movies are broken down much more simple, probably because of the idea, and that's almost all movies that had that there was a book of the movie, and then the movie itself. The movie is more simple, probably with the idea in mind that the people who make the movie have the idea of saying, well, most people who go to the movies don't really read the book, so let's make it simple for them. And the action part of him always being successful in the actions in movies of that such also impresses black people also, because of our consistency in real life of failure. And a white movie director can really make easy gains by doing that in movies, having that black character be successful, live at the end of the movie, as opposed to getting horribly killed in some sort of way, you know, that sort of thing, you know. And so those are just some of the thoughts that I had with the second reading. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. Let's see. Yeah, that is true. Shaft in the film, he has a lot of like witty one-liners. Incidentally, many of them are, I got laid. He says that numerous times. That's his one-liner to people's response about what he did or where he's going, always getting back to the genital level. But oh yeah, I'm sure that's, and I think for movies too, in general, they don't have as much time. Like books, generally people take sometimes a week, a month, sometimes depends, you know, how long it takes, how fast you read. Even fast readers generally take longer than 90 minutes, you know, to read a book. This isn't even a very long book, and the audiobook I think is still like 7 hours or something. Most movies aren't 7 hours, so they have to convey all that information quickly, you know, 90 minutes, get it all in. So I mean, like, I think Malcolm X's autobiography, it took us like 3 months, maybe even longer than that, to read the whole thing. That movie's 3 hours. So a lot, like, oh, and like exactly what you said, frequently people don't read the book, so you will be totally unaware that you are missing a lot of information, especially if it's about an authentic situation, autobiography of Malcolm X. You will be missing a lot of detail if you just rely on the movie. I don't even, like I said, if I read this book, do you take the role, Shaft? We can think about that as we kind of get through this. But if you're Richard Roundtree, you read this book, say, all right, Richard, you want your breakout role? You could be John Shaft. We'll have to think about that one as we continue reading. We are beyond the halfway point, so we've read enough to, you know, have an opinion, I think. You read 50% or more of a book, you got the general flavor of what's being presented. That's us. Some of the notes that I took. Let me back up, because we had a little bit of chapter 7. This whole scene where Shaft is on the phone, he's pretending to be bartender. And so he's talking to Andrazi,
And, well, first he's talking to this female who I think is white. And then he's talking to the white cop Andarazi. The white gangsters at the bar are fascinated. Oh my goodness. We know the black male and the black female. Now a white man is writing this. We said he's obsessed with, you know, black genitalia. I wrote that today. I'm so disappointed. I didn't read this book when Dr. Welsing was with us. She would have had so much to say about this. The artwork for the movies, did you know? What just your analysis based on that, since so many black people have revered this film franchise for decades? We are told that this is black culture, something to be proud of. But this whole scene, this is not in the, I guess they are, the white guys are there because this does happen in the movie. Shaft gets on the phone, he's talking to the white man, and it's exactly this. It sounds like he's asking for a date, and the white guys are sitting there kind of giggling and watching this. So this is in the movie. It's just not as over the top. That's why I said, like, ooh, was this movie made for black people? Let's see. That conversation, even when he's talking to Andarazi, how about you coming down to see old Big Jim? Big Jim. I got what you want, baby. Incidentally, there were victims who said, there's a lot of baby in this movie. Males talking to other males, baby this, and hey, baby, and what you doing, baby? True. Dr. Well, that's what I said. So chapter 8. He wondered, remembering the line from Lenny Bruce or Dick Gregory, the late, if Johnson & Johnson would one day bring out black Band-Aids for the 25 million other flesh tones. They do have other flesh tones of Band-Aids, so they were wrong on this one. But the late Dick Gregory, also a guest on The Cows. The enforcement officers talking about Shaft say that he doesn't stop to think a lot. So we've had that line of thinking presented twice, that black people are all emotional, passion. They don't think. They're not strategic. He says Shaft, he acts. And every ounce of the man is muscle and anger. Even that's kind of homoerotic there too. I missed one. When they have the bar fight, he cracks the white guy over the head with the bottle and cuts his hand. That's in the movie. Cuts his hand. The white woman comes and bandages. That's in the film book, right in sync. In the book, he gets home, sees the cut, sees the cut, and he licks it. He says, outside the ones in which he had trapped them, Nickerson was deep into the Dracula fantasy. The girls were giggling. He has that whole scene where he sucks the cud and imitates Dracula's voice. Said, ooh, we talked about that, the white author, mummies, cannibals, all of that, about necrophilia and all the rest of it, I think 2012. And in that book, he talks about why the vampire mythology is so powerful. Decades and decades and decades, people have been writing and making all these movies and Dracula and vampire movies. All of that is cannibalism. That also is the delectable Negro. We talked about both of those concepts before. They can be ubiquitous within the system of white supremacy, even literally devouring black people. Who knows, he said, sounding confused, dumb, because Charlie sometimes accepted his dumbness as an excuse. All niggers are crazy. As soon as the cop had the handcuffs on me, he leans over and hits me with the bottle. Somebody must have tipped him. So this is when the gangsters are talking, you know, why did he hit you with the bottle and how did he pick us out and all the rest of it? And he can't even just be truthful and, oh, yeah, I spit on him and, you know, he cracked me. I should have got cracked. I'm spreading Rona and all the rest of it. And then, like, I can't even say that he tipped me. Who would have done that? That doesn't make sense. Like, we were stupid. We're sitting right in the front of the bar. All these black people like, yeah, that's, you know, that's going to kind of stand out. Let's see. Did I get all the... I think those are all the notes that I had on the second audio segment. Is anything... Anybody else need to make sure they get in?
Yes, I would like to report that from a historical standpoint, especially in movies, probably in writing also, that there was not a whole lot of black on white violence that took place. White people were not attempting to promote that. Some of the early instances in movies, it was rather shocking, if you will, when Sidney Poitier slapped this white male in the heat of the night, that slapped him first. It just didn't happen that much. I would say probably Jim Brown probably got the opportunity more as an actor than any other actor during that time. And doing those so-called black exploitation movies, like I said before, the white people who put those movies together wanted black people to feel good about themselves, so to speak. And that was one of the ways to do it, by quote unquote, getting at the man sort of thing, killing white people or beating up white people, that sort of thing, in those movies, that took place in, the Shaft movie was one of the first of ones that created that type of action. I put it that way. That was something that also attracted black people to those movies also, especially black males.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. There was lots of that. This movie doesn't really have that. At least in the book, we've read more than 50% of it. We haven't had that, except, well, he did get to crack one on the head with a bottle. So that's one. We'll have to see the rest of, not to hop ahead, but so we do at least have one where he's popped this white guy with a bottle for spitting on him. So
I can recall that when that actually happened. And there was a large arousal of black people in the movie when he did that, when he made that reaction to that white guy spitting in his face in the movie. Because he did it immediately. You know, I mean, bang, bang. Yeah.
That's what I said, but that time, it would have to be known, like, oh, yeah, black people are going to, because, I mean, you just didn't have black people on television all the time the way that it is
right
now. Like, black athletes and, you know, elected officials, presidents and all. I mean, that just was not the case 50 years ago. So this was like, whoa, what in the world? Like, wow, he's cracking a white guy over the head with a bottle, doesn't go to jail, doesn't get arrested, is not cooperating with the police, sleeping with a white woman. Wow. Shaft. Negro legend. Imitated for decades. Like, as is Sidney Poitier. That was legendary as well. The, you know, my name is Mr. Tibbs.
Mr. Tibbs.
That was the phrase. That said for decades. People still say that on the timeline. That's still, my name is Mr. Tibbs. But yeah, that, you know, for that time period, I mean, even still, that's something I would think about. Like, they obviously changed some things for the movie and they kept some aspects in. But I mean, even within that, that scene where he hits him with the bottle, like the light guy had just grabbed his behind like 3 minutes before that happens. And then he sleeps with the white woman like 3 minutes after it happens. She bandages his cut hand afterwards. So it's like, whoo, you got to snatch those moments, I guess, to be proud or happy quickly. And then it's right back to, like, oh, man, nah. Wait for the next bit to come. But think about that as we're going. Like, if you're Richard Roundtree, you read this book, Ernest Tidyman, do you take this role? Gordon Parks, they ask, hey, this is phenomenal. We got an idea, Shaft, black superhero. We want you to direct it. You read this book?
You know what I think about that, Gus? It is all of the participants, when, from my understanding, I could be wrong, when you're putting together a movie, you have a segment, the other person has a segment in it where they play their part, but you really don't see the whole thing until after everything is finalized. And then you probably would, by you seeing the whole thing, you probably would regret the part that you played in it. You know, because the person who puts all those things together, they're about the only ones that have the idea how the movie comes out in the end. And I don't think they really tell the participants. You know, so the participants really don't find out until after things are finalized. And then everybody go in and have like I forgot what it's called, a little pre-watching of the movie and whatnot. And by that time, you know, they probably have lawyered up and everything to whereas, hey, you agreed to come and participate and do your part. So you can't talk about, you need to cut me out of that. You know, it's too late. You know, so I don't know. Maybe it's not that way, but those just my thoughts on it. Because yeah, I can see where some people would say, "Man, I didn't know I was going for this in the end." You know, that sort of thing. But yeah,
much obliged, retired firefighter. That is common. Again, as I said, Ernest Tidyman, hey, he wrote the book. He co-wrote the screenplay. He knew, you know, the vision for this from the very beginning. I said that before. He was on board with this project before. Richard Roundtree, Isaac Hayes, Gordon Parks. I wrote the book, man. You all are following my vision. And in this instance, the studio, MGM, Mr. Tidyman, they're going to have a lot more sway over what's going to happen as opposed to really any of the actors. That Richard Roundtree was a nobody at this time, so he didn't have any, you know, pull. I'm sure he wasn't paid a whole lot to come in about the script and what it was going to be and all of that. All of that said, I just thought all this. I thought it was important to include. Mr. Roundtree has talked about repeatedly that, you know, so many black people said that this role inspired them to, you know, try to be – to do something more and to not just, you know, accept racism, white supremacy, to go out and do something better with their lives. So I do think that's constructive. But again, I think that just speaks more to, wow, they did not allow black people on television at all, like at all. So just almost anything, having black people who are doing something other than sweeping, cleaning the bathroom is, wow, that's incredible. I've never seen that before. So apparently, a lot of black people were inspired to do something constructive beyond just wearing leather jackets and turtlenecks, bopping along to Isaac Hayes. even though there was a lot of that. Anywho, we will call it a segment for this week. Again, we probably only have like two left max, and we are all done. This book is not very long, thankfully. But we'll have some questions to think about as we go. Both of the females, are we sure they're white in the books, in the book that Shaft has been engaged in sexual intercourse with? If you're reading this book and then you're asked to be involved in this project, what do you think? Even if you're new, if you've never done this, you know, this is your opportunity to break into Hollywood. One that we can think about as well. Who was this book or movie made for? That's a big one, too. Was this made for black people? We'll think about that, too. Anyway, we'll be here for Neutralizing Workplace Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Much obliged for folks listening in live archive. Hope it was worthy of your Thursday evening. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Lots of alcohol there at the bar and all this wackiness is going down. Police have to be called. That is common. In addition to being sober, if you're going out and about, be alert. If someone is being hostile and loud, no verbal confrontations. You should be thinking that person could be armed. If you didn't leave your residence, prepare to kill and or die, exit. This is not the time to be having confrontations in public with strangers. They may have an entire armed entourage. If you're driving, you're buckled, sober. If you're driving, you're not on the cell phone, just doing the small things to keep ourselves as safe as possible. All that's it, Creator. We ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm up. A victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.